Okay, so welcome to episode 64 of Strike and Mike. What's up, Striker?
How you doing, Mike?
All right, so I wanted to start off the conversation today by talking about some Globo Homo shit. Of course, this is high level. We're hitting levels of Globo Homo that were previously thought impossible and probably should be impossible. So this weekend, Burger King came out, and as we know, there's been some tension in Britain, in Old Blighty, over the European parliamentary elections and the various people standing for them. So we did a rundown on Tedious with Morgoth of the various parties. So there's, Sargon is standing for UKIP. Yeah. Tommy Robinson is standing for, he's standing, right? I believe
yes,
he's standing
yes. in the election. I'm not sure if it's for UKIP or the Brexit Party, one of the two.
I think it might be Brexit Party. He's with, what's her name, Anne-Marie Waters? Because Brexit Party...
Oh, Anne-Marie Waters is, I think, in a new party, which is...
Oh, for Britain, for Britain, yes. For right, Britain. Okay. So Brexit Party...
Morrissey is a part of that, too, by the way.
Well, he's been pimping it. So, all right, let's get this all straight. So, yeah. So UKIP, Sargon, and Count Dankula. Sargon is standing for the MEP. For Britain is Anne-Marie Waters, who was UKIP and was Brexit Party, but now I think has formed her own even further right party, although that is sort of a very anti-Islam party. That's like the...
Yeah, she's a lesbian.
Yes, she was a Marxist lesbian who kind of went to the right and now is doing the... Although Morgoth has told me that she went from being kind of that liberal pro-homosexual critique of Islam to being more... kind of pro-white in the way the alt-right would be, where she's talking about the anti-whiteness as a thing rather than just anti-homosexuality. And she's talking about even like Kalergi plan and stuff like that. So she's kind of going like even in a very sort of alt-right direction to the extent that you can. And then there's the Brexit Party. I think that's where Tommy Robinson is Brexit Party. And that's also Farage. Farage's party, which is running on a purely...
The Brexit Party, for people that don't know, the Brexit Party is one, it's one issue, Brexit. Mm-hmm. So there's actually people that range from the far left to the far right running as Brexit candidates. Even George Galloway was actually trying out. He's openly endorsed the Brexit Party, by the way.
Mm-hmm. These elections, though.
George Galloway was being attacked on a Trotskyist site as a Stalinist Nazi. And that's because he comes from a Stalinist background, and his whole point is that, like, how can we be for the working class and then join with technocrats and plutocrats and oligarchs to overturn Brexit?
Right.
So he's just being consistent. The people that are being inconsistent are all these trots and kikes that are working on the other side saying, no, 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 no. It's actually bigoted and fascist to be for Brexit. So
George
came very close to running as a Brexit candidate, but actually Nigel Farage turned him down because he said you're too extreme.
Well, the other thing is though that George Galloway is already Labour Party and he's in Parliament already, so he's just endorsing. I believe he was just endorsing Brexit Party, but only for European Parliament elections, because as we talked about, mm-hmm. European parliamentary elections don't have very much meaning. It's kind of a symbolic post where the European Commission decides things without the input of Parliament. The Parliament is asked to rubber stamp things, but if they don't, it doesn't really matter. And it's basically, it's like a little bit of a place where you can get up and grandstand, but you can't really do much. But
it is good in that sense, because it's good to get your message out.
Yeah.
And they also give you money to do things. So for example, the Alliance for Peace and Freedom, which is the coalition of Golden Dawn, Nick Griffin, mm-hmm. Roberto Fiore, Nordic Resistance Movement, the Slovak Party, and NPD, Udo Voigt, they are using, if I recall correctly, they're using like European funds that like go to Syria and meet Assad and stuff, which is kind of cool. Yeah. They also use it to invest in their groups and so on. So it is good for that. Like, it's not like it's for nothing. But yeah,
no,
it has
it's not for nothing at all. It's a big, but it's
power. Yeah.
They don't really have any actual legislative power, so it's kind of ridiculous to call them a parliament. It's more of just like a place where people can go. And I mean, Farage was in it for years, and he had all those speeches. That's why when everyone thought, see, this is the other thing. Everyone thought Farage. This is when everyone thought Farage was so based. Because he would go in and he would just take the piss out of the EU, and he would say some even bordering on alt-right talking points, and everyone liked it. And I liked it too. But we see that Farage you know, now that he's gained some real power, he's become just kind of a neoliberal again. But a neoliberal
Farage is it's like Nick Griffin once said. He said Farage is a used car salesman.
Yes.
Okay, so the guy's great at what he does. I hope one day we have the power and money to hire Farage because he's very effective and he's very charming. Mm-hmm. But let's not trick ourselves either. You know, let's not put on any blinkers.
No.
The man is a bit of a con man.
Oh yeah, definitely. He doesn't really. You get the feeling that you know, he's not necessarily invested in what he's saying. Although, you know, when he was also dog whistling very hard. I mean, I remember I was talking to somebody from Britain, and I was talking about, you know, my criticism and Morgoth's criticism of Sargon, which we talked about it a little bit as well in our last show. We talked about the death of liberalistism, where we're like the death of skepticism and liberalistism, where like these people's the constituencies don't want just like edgy individualistic nihilism and atheism or whatever anymore. They want they don't want to just BTFO and trigger the libs anymore. They want somebody that actually with substance behind them.
Right.
And so, you know, there's that, but it's like, you know, this guy was telling me that, no, you're wrong. Everyone in Britain is just a soy boy. Nobody really wants that anymore. There's no audience for that. And I was just disagreeing with him. And I was like, well, why then when Farage won Brexit, did he go out there and say, we won this for the decent people, for the working people, for the family people? Like, who do you think he's talking about, guy?
And who voted for Brexit?
Yeah, no, I know. It's like who when you go out after an election where all the white people voted one way, mm-hmm. and, you know, or all the people that voted one way were white, rather. There was white people that voted the other way, too. But when you do that, and you say the good people, the decent people, the working people, family people, you're talking about white people. He's talking about white people. And the guy was like, no, I don't think he was. I was like, guy,
Morgoth was telling me that the base of support for Brexit was actually in the deindustrialized regions. So, like, for example, in the north of Britain, which is very similar and has the same problems, actually, as the Midwest of America. Mm-hmm. It's actually uncanny. The same problems, the drugs, the deindustrialization, poverty.
Same genetics, too.
Yeah, well, not necessarily. As the Midwest is German and Irish,
well,
but
you know, I was thinking Scots Irish.
Similar, for sure, a similar culture, similar trajectory in the attack on these people. So, of course, all the global homo soy boys would be like, "Oh, you have this one car factory in the north. How could you be supporting Brexit?" And they're like, "Yeah, but you know, look at all these civic and cultural and social and economic problems." Aside from this one factory that we have, and you guys aren't doing anything because of the new world order is centered around a few capital cities where all the wealth and money is concentrated there, and the people in these other regions and especially in the countryside are totally forgotten. So you know what? That they did the one thing that they have at their disposal to get back at the urban cosmopolitan elites, and that was to vote, and they all voted for Brexit.
Yeah,
you know,
and the same people all voted for Trump here.
Yeah,
the same kind of people voted for Trump here.
The blue wall. Again, I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe that the north of England is traditionally Labour.
Yes,
traditionally Labour.
It's Labour, but it's also
So just for some historic background here, the last great strike in the United Kingdom happened
exactly
in the north
where I was going.
In the north of England, and it was the miners' strike.
It was really militant, too.
Very militant. And this was before, really, all the Trotskyists and anarchists and weirdos started to infiltrate and salt unions their activists to become shop stewards to steer the union. This was actually just homegrown families in the countryside centered around the pub. It was the good old-fashioned salt
union. That's why it was militant, because it didn't have these global homo Marxists coming in and trying to take over. Because that diffuses this shit right away. It was based in the local community. And the local people there who didn't have a conception that they were fighting for international Marxism. They had a conception that they were fighting for their own livelihoods.
Yeah, well, the remarkable thing about unions in the Anglo-Saxon world is that they've traditionally stuck to one issue, which is improving the lives of their workers and their families. They've never really delved into the other places of, we have to support gay marriage and we have to do this and that. So what you do notice, though, is that once that stuff starts filtering into the unions, then you start to see them getting weaker and weaker.
Yeah, well, that stuff did start after the 1980s. And in the U.S., at least, I don't know as much about England, but typically these countries follow similar trajectories. The U.S., the unions now are all about that stuff. And so guys in unions that I know and have talked to have been like, they don't like the union. And when you talk about, you know, sometimes even pro-union stuff triggers them because they're like, look, this thing is nothing but, like, frankly, faggot shit. It's all faggot shit. All they talk about is getting women, people of color, like, diversity bullshit. Like, there's nothing, you know, it's like, other than maybe, that's like, I'd say, like, the labor unions. Like, trade unions are something different. Like, some people still have some loyalty to trade unions, like electricians and things like that. But the labor unions, yeah, the ones that are organizing factory workers, like the UAW and stuff, that's all global homo shit. All the time.
I've actually looked into this, and they spend a lot more money on political donations than they do on union organizing. Mm-hmm. Two or three times more. And the reason for this – The conservative argument is that it's a racket, but it's not really. Part of that is the unions are reacting to the party. So the unions have had to jump in with the Democratic Party because the GOP is extremely hostile to them. So you can't separate that from the fact that unions went from being the number one anti-immigration lobby in America until Ronald Reagan. So obviously something changed. I mean, unions have been pushing anti-immigration laws since the times of Samuel Gompers. So a communist Jew in the 1910s and 20s was more based on immigration than Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Okay. So So clearly there's something that happened in the Reagan era, and it was simply the attack. All these things that conservatives cheer for, like when Reagan sacked all the air traffic control guys that were striking and things like that. Well, guess what? If you're cheering for that and you're against immigration, you're an idiot, because that is why – unions are weak now. They are forced into the arms of the Democratic Party, which also emphasizes global homo shit. So now what do you have? You have unions that have to respond to that just to cling for life. Unions now, the only way they can operate is by getting contracts from the state. Okay.
Yeah.
So they're just clinging
to that. Climate. You've got to do all the global homo stuff. And
exactly. And
every company that contracts with the government has, if you ever go and you look, say, military contractors, everyone was talking about the phenomena a couple months ago where, like, there was this, in Britain, one of the top military contractors has a homosexual CEO, and they were putting out homosexual themed advertising and stuff like that and propaganda. And then you go and you look in the U.S. and you see the same thing, maybe not quite as like in your face as that. But if you go to any military contractor, just as an example, go to their website and you look, and they all have their statement of diversity, which is something that's required. Yeah. And so I'm not going to do the libertarian thing where say like, these companies want to be based, but because of the government, they have to be gay. That's
stupid.
That's really dumb. It's all part of a complex. I mean, we call it a complex for a reason. And it's really just, affected by the viewpoint of the elite, whether it's corporate, whether it's government.
As a microcosm of this, think of Joe Biden's candidacy, right?
Yeah.
So the deal with Joe Biden is that he's going to defend the Judeo left on cultural issues, as long as the Judeo left doesn't push him against the wall on economic ones.
Which they're not going to.
Right. So Joe Biden's going out there saying, well, you have to support me in order to stop the Nazis from taking away your abortion rights and taking away your racial equality and mass immigration. So what he does with that is he anticipates an attack from the left, and he neutralizes it, because if the left is putting down – because so here's how the coalition works. This is how it worked in the 1930s, and this is how it works now. So when America and Britain knew Joseph Stalin was a vicious tyrant and a communist murderer, and Joseph Stalin knew that Winston Churchill and FDR were capitalist murderers. So they put all this aside to destroy the Nazis as the third existential threat. In order to do that, in modern day times, the left has to drop all critics or criticisms of neoliberal capitalism itself, while the capitalists have to endorse and embrace the kooky, weird sex stuff and the bizarre racial stuff and the mass immigration stuff. And that's how you get this new coalition of the left being submerged in this neoliberal goo. And that's how you get shit like self-described communists throwing eggs at workers that support Brexit.
Yeah, and how you get even into the realm of the totally bizarre, or seemingly bizarre, but actually totally makes sense, to how you get soy boys in video game t-shirts purchasing corporate product to throw at Nigel Farage.
As an act of communist
An act of communist, supposedly communist rebellion. And Burger King tweets out their encouragement for this. I mean, they were responding to the phenomena of Sargon and Tommy Robinson getting hit with milkshakes, but Farage was considered a little bit higher tier than them, you know? They were kind of like more street level, more like social media for Sargon and street level for Tommy Robinson. So it's not surprising that they would mix it up with people. But Farage is like, he's got a little bit more class than that. I'm not saying I believe this. This is the presentation. So he's not supposed to, he's a little bit above this. He's a higher level than this. And I'm also amazed that his security team allowed this kid to get, this fat boy, this fat soy child to get anywhere near him. Well, but anyway, he did.
If he can get a milkshake through, who says he can't get an acid?
Which is exactly what people have been saying. And conservatives and right wingers and alt right and whoever, everybody opposed to everyone that, if not even just opposed to, just disgusted by it. Just disgusted by the spectacle of all of the, basically all of the left from the supposedly hard left to the squishy middle liberalism are on board with this, throwing milkshakes at the mean people. That's really what it is. Throw a milkshake at a meanie for capitalism.
Well, think of how childish that is, though. I mean,
it's totally,
is that really? Are
childish.
You really that? Are you out of arguments? I mean, you can probably debate Farage and beat him, but you've just given that up.
There's
a new book by a new neoliberal Jew. Again, the only people that will defend neoliberalism are Jews, Steven Pinker, and so on. No. There's a new one by Adam Gopnik, defending liberalism as the most moral thing, blah, blah, blah. So ultimately, the reaction to this new book, all the soy media, soy-controlled media, soy-infused media, all of it is actually mocking him. So on some level, the Judeo left, or the soy left, they have come to terms with the end of liberalism.
Yes.
So what does that mean? Well, that means that they're no longer going to even pay lip service to free expression, freedom of assembly, the right for people to oppose your policy, or even people to vote against your policy in overwhelming numbers without you vetoing it, without any, you know, real democratic authority. So what does that mean? Well, that translates in real life to man boobs over here in a Pokemon shirt or a fucking
Street Fighter
shirt. So, you know, man boobs in a Street Fighter shirt. He's been alerted to this new mentality in his clique. And he's now, what are they doing? They're throwing eggs at people. They're throwing milkshakes at people. And they're just, and trust me.
Well, dude, the funniest thing about this.
They're going to start going for worse and worse things.
The funniest thing about it is
shooting at each other.
Is that he, and when the dude, I swear to God, they have turned – it's like – I mean, there's that, but there's also – I mean, look, you could talk about the increased threat of violence and things like that, but also there's a level of absurdity here of the absolute corporatization of it. And I would say that by turning it from bricks and rocks and sticks and potentially bullets to milkshakes, corporate capitalism has commodified it, and they've made it less dangerous. Milkshake, obviously less dangerous than a rock or a brick or a stick, but they've also then opened it up to these soft middle class soy boys. They're like, go do it, you can do this communist LARPing too. And then the guy, when he was arrested, he told the press like what it was. He's like, oh, this was like a 575 like spiced ginger latte from whatever franchise. He's like, I was looking forward to drinking. I was like, you look like you probably drank one too many of those, you know, guy. But you know, maybe it was better for you to have thrown it than you get a little exercise in rather than just to drink more sugary treats.
Then
but
drink
like,
it.
but so it's like it becomes an advertisement. And Burger King, now one could argue, well, Burger King is being cynical. Well, obviously Burger King is being fucking cynical. But it's amazing that Burger King, then you saw labor politicians who are supposed to be against Burger King for their labor policies, right? In theory.
Yeah.
Labor politicians are retweeting and being, I'm going to go have a Whopper this weekend. So then they start pimping Burger King products. You see a lot of like shitty liberals doing the same, like these middle class, you know, the middle class twats. You see them doing the same. And you see Antifa, like, was pretty, you know, people were then posting pictures of Antifa with Burger King logos, just how like Pepsi was sponsoring Antifa a couple years ago in Berkeley, like they were getting free Pepsi. Now Burger King is their sponsor. So it's like they can't, I mean, it's like
open. Well, what this does, I think, what you're getting at here is that it opens up the prospect of political violence to bourgeois.
Yes, bugmen. Exactly. It totally does.
They're being deputized. They're being you know, a bourgeois bugman isn't going to go to Pim Fortune's house and shoot him. At least not yet.
No.
But right now they're getting them comfortable with political violence.
Yes, exactly. Okay, exactly. They're softening them. They're already soft, but they're, shall we say, softening them up. Or, you know, it's like they wouldn't, nor would a bourgeois bugman have gone to, say, Berkeley 2 years ago to fight with Identity Europa and you know, all the other, and the Patriot Prayer or the Proud Boys or whatever other groups were there. You know, they would not have gone there to do that. They would have, like, watched from their TV and snickered as an Antifa, you know, pulled someone out of the crowd and hit him with a skateboard, you know, something like that. But they wouldn't go themselves.
Right.
You know, the people that were doing that were mentally ill people on drugs. But now they're opening it up to the, like, that guy probably is like a JavaScript programmer in his daily life. You know, he probably writes HTML code for some shitty website.
One thing, obviously, we always go back to this moment, the moment Richard Spencer got punched, right? Mm. That really changed everything, not because of the violence, but because of the way the media and the talking heads reacted to it, which was quite 50-50 at the time. Mm-hmm. I was actually astonished that so many people would go out there and be like, well, you know, he did get punched and, you know, you shouldn't be punching people, but – and that's when it all started.
Now they leave out the but. I mean, now they don't go with the qualification at the beginning. They leave out the you shouldn't be punching
that's
people.
That's totally gone. Now there's not a single – there's very few people that on the left or even in the middle that will go out there and say, oh, there's fewer of them rather. I mean, there are some still, but you get more and more stuff like the New Republic has this new article. It says Why Milkshaking Works, and it's by a guy named Matt Ford. Who, you know, if you look this guy up on Twitter, he is exactly what you'd imagine he looks like. He's got the beard. He loves bacon! Bacon! You know how bugmen are with their bacon. They're
They love to fetishize various commodities.
I need bacon. I want bacon ice cream and bacon toothpaste and I want bacon candy. Oh, bacon! So you got that. And Bill Murray. So you got, like, you know, 3 years ago, Vice created this culture where they had, you know, like, 10 reasons why Bill Murray is so cool type of shit. And now that same publication, after building this counterculture, this fake AstroTurf counterculture, they are weaponizing these people in a political fashion to say, hey, do you love Bill Murray memes? Do you love bacon? Do you love Game of Thrones? Well, those things are all under attack now by people like Nigel Farage. So it's your duty to take this product and throw it at him, and then wait to consume the next product to throw.
Yeah, that was my thing. I was like, don't ask questions. Just throw product at fascists. Get excited to throw next product at fascists. And dude, so then this account on Twitter today, actually, they just blocked me. Of this account called Space Communism, their handle is Karl Marx the Capitalism Liker. Was talking about, like, Richard Spencer afraid to leave his house. You know, Tommy Robinson, blah, 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 this, that. Like, basically talking about how their tactics are working. And I'm like, your tactics are only working because you have the backing of, you know, the police and capitalism.
Yeah. Oh, give me a break. Those tactics weren't working. I mean, did they work at the Battle of Sacramento? I mean, you threw...
Yeah, it wasn't them. It wasn't... If it was purely Antifa... just Antifa and they had no backing from the courts, the police, and big capital, they would just get their asses beat.
Yeah, exactly.
But they have the backing. I mean, that's why Street Fighter guy here has the courage to do what he did, because he's got all of this official backing. That guy, like, well, you really think a guy like that would,
if he plays in Street Fighter, you can actually play with a huge handicap in your direction. And that's kind of what he's doing in real life.
Yes.
He's playing with a massive handicap on his opponent. He's playing on easy mode.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in real life, unlike in Street Fighter, if you lose, you can press the reset button. But in real life, if you initiate political violence and your enemy or your opponent is actually stronger than you, you're fucked. And there's no reset button. You're just going to get your ass kicked and you're going to be hospitalized. So, like, you know, are you seriously going to – so the one thing about bugmen that is really fascinating is how they like to take credit for institutional momentum. Yeah. So an institution will push something in a direction. Yeah. They help push it as a yapping lapdog. So, for example, say you're a nationalist, right? You're at Charlottesville. You're fighting the leftist scum. You're fighting the police. You're fighting the courts. You're fighting the media. You're fighting the world.
Metaphorically speaking, naturally.
Right, exactly. And and here you have a guy with a milkshake, which is the equivalent of a yapping dog, basically tugging at your pant leg while you battle the entire world.
Yeah, and so, then he gets accolades across the media. I mean, the UK Independent ran a story celebrating him. I'm sure the Guardian article celebrating him is soon coming, you know, if it's not out already. And so what really did you do that was brave or courageous? A capitalist franchise went out and said, throw milkshakes at Nigel Farage. Yeah. That was the clear implication of the tweet from Burger King. Also, Burger King's CEO is a guy named Schwarz. So he's a Jew. He's like, I saw a picture of him. He's actually young, but he's very Jewish. So what are you really doing? You're not brave in any way. A big company says, buy our soy-infused high-fructose corn syrup product and then toss it at a fascist dude. And then all the Bugman media also gets on you. So you're not really doing anything at all.
Yeah, talk about guerrilla advertising over here. Another problem here, I mean, this goes to show you, this is why any nationalist movement needs to have a hard, hard anti-capitalist line, because there's not a single company that will support Nigel Farage, is there? So
even though Human
Events, which is the new Human Events, which is the new Zionist AstroTurf,
we gotta talk about this. Yeah.
So they wrote an article praising Dunkin' Donuts, because Dunkin' Donuts was recently asked, like, why they don't engage in politics. Right. And they said, well, we don't engage in politics because we're not Starbucks. And and of course, Will Chamberlain and co., and I believe Ian Miles Chung, they were praising Dunkin' Donuts to the high heavens for staying apolitical.
For not being political. But think about it. This is so typical of conservatives.
Yep.
It's like Dunkin' Donuts is the perfect conservative company because it's not fighting.
Right. It's also all full of H-1B franchise owners. Like,
dude. Dunkin' Donuts are owned by Pajit. Pajit's aren't going to get political. It's owned by Pajit.
Dunkin' Donuts is pure fucking cancer. Because if you have a local coffee shop that's built up its neighborhood and reputation for like three decades, you'll get some fucking dothead doing research on it and be like, oh, this is a place that people like coffee. And then they open up a Dunkin' Donuts across the street. They put out free coupons for about a month to get free coffee and donuts. Then they put the local coffee shop out of business.
Yeah, that Starbucks does the same shit. I mean, the local coffee shop
Starbucks is expensive. No, Starbucks is expensive. Dunkin' Donuts is kind of cheap. So
yeah, but when's the last time you saw a local coffee shop, dude?
Yeah. No, that's true.
I mean, it's not even just because people – I mean, look, Starbucks – I mean, Starbucks, of course, appeals to they corporatized the leftist conceit of like sitting in coffee shops and engaging in political discussion, which is fine. I mean, that is a thing that people did for a long time. It's a natural place to do it. But I like doing it too. It's funny. The first time,
when I
got involved in politics years ago, I actually went to go meet a guy from this communist party to talk to him, and we went to to a Starbucks. Of course, this was like 20 some years ago, but
if you go to Southern Europe, if you go to a Mediterranean country, and even some Central European countries, the coffee shop is where the politics get done.
Yeah.
Okay. That not just the right, not just the left, but also the right. Like a lot of great people gather in coffee shops and have debates and discourse. And that's something I kind of miss, because you know, if you're doing that at a coffee shop, Zog isn't watching you; they can't hear you. If you're doing it over the internet, they can potentially be watching you while you do that. So they know,
you know, and everything you say can be captured. So, and potentially some ANCAPs, used against you.
Exactly. Some ANCAPs will be like, well, the government made a huge mistake in creating the internet. Did they really make a mistake? I mean, yeah, to a point they are suffering for it. But at the same time, they can see everything. They couldn't see everything back 50 years ago when people were plotting conspiracies.
Well, I would say it's a double-edged sword. There's risks and benefits to it. It's not one or the other. But yeah, no. But the thing is, there was also less dissent because ideas were less easy to get around.
Yeah.
Like you had to have like a newsletter or something, which they have no ability to stop somebody printing out a newsletter and mailing it to people, and it's incredibly hard to dox and know what these people are. You know, like, what do you, right. You can't know who the other subscribers are, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, but like, again, the circulation of those papers is like what, like 500 people, 1,000 people?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know? So it's like, yeah,
it's such a challenge. I mean,
and how do you get a new person interested?
They have to, like, the equivalent of Strike and Mike, which was like Race and Reason by Tom Metzger. It was only broadcast in like 5 cities, yeah. And it was over cable access TV. So you had to catch it on like a Tuesday at 11 o'clock at night.
The interesting thing was they wouldn't censor that. Nowadays, you would not. If we tried to do, to the extent there is cable public access, like, even though public access is supposed to be public access, like, you're supposed to be allowed to just use it. And the idea that you can't use it for stuff that's like obscene or even potentially violent is wrong, because I've seen shit on New York City public access late at night that you wouldn't believe. But you know, now they do put that stuff on late at night. But the idea that, like, you couldn't put a political white nationalist message out,
oh, absolutely.
20 years ago, that would have been ridiculous. You would have actually gotten on First Amendment grounds. You would have won. But these days, I don't know.
They wouldn't even make you sue them. They would just let you do it, like they.
Oh no, yeah, you wouldn't. You would just be allowed to do it, like,
because the people that were usually in charge of these things, like not ham radio, but shortwave radio and stuff like that. The people that own these things usually had a very libertarian mindset, and they usually were affiliated with the conspiracy theory movement.
Yeah.
So, like, they didn't really care.
That's the shortwave radio community, public access TV. The people that run it just didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
They just didn't care.
Yep.
You know, if you were white, like, because there's so much, there's actually YouTube videos you could find of like old white nationalist stuff, or even like Klan stuff, you know, from like the 80s and 90s and stuff. You could find that stuff. But yeah, like, nowadays, though, I don't, you know, to the extent that even exists anymore, I don't think they would let us on it.
If it was 1988 and you wanted to have a Ku Klux Klan themed barbecue cooking show, you could have that on cable access.
Yeah.
So,
like, they actually had some amount. There was actually people. I mean, granted, it was like a small concession that these monopolistic cable companies made for coming in and monopolizing, which is, okay, we'll make one channel available for the public. But, you know, very few people wanted to do it. And those shows didn't really go anywhere. I mean,
right. You know, but, you know, the model can easily be applied to the internet. Yeah. You have the private, if you want to have the privately owned Facebook and the privately owned Google, fine, but have a government alternative, government access, public access alternative that everyone can use.
Yes.
And that model, why is that model off the table? Why is that?
There's no more. And why wouldn't it be on the table for not just for social media, but also banking?
Or YouTube.
Why do we not have an option for banking where you, the government, where you, because look, ultimately, I've been saying this for a while, actually. We kind of got off the topic. Well, we did the topic of the soy boys and milkshakes. I've been saying this for a while. And when you look at the structure of banking in the United States, you know, a lot of people say end the Fed and audit the Fed, and they blame the Federal Reserve for all the problems. I think that's just backwards. I think we should have not that I like what the Federal Reserve does, or like, the Federal Reserve is an interesting thing. I think that the reactionary position of end it and let the banks go back to hard money and private
banking—that's
literally retarded. Like, if
you have
think
to nationalize
that,
it,
that's exactly what I was going to say. Nationalize the Federal Reserve. Like, it's already effectively nationalized. It's just only nationalized for the private banks, which are middlemen between you and the Fed, and they get really low interest rates.
Is the Fed nationalized, or is our Congress and government privatized? That's the question.
Well, that's the thing. So
the relationship they have with the Fed is one of, oh, this is where I eat. This is the trough. So if I don't do what they say, we're fucked. We can't keep
paying. And on top of that, the Federal Reserve has private shareholders, and that's sort of what Ron Paul was doing when he was saying audit the Fed. Like, we do deserve to know who those people are and what kind of profits.
It's unbelievable that we don't.
And it's unbelievable that we don't. We deserve to know who they are and what kind of profits they're making. And the system and the structure of the Federal Reserve would be very easy to nationalize. And all the banks, all the branch banks, every bank is effectively already a subsidiary of the Federal Reserve Bank. It's where they borrow their money from. It's where they get their money that they loan to you at interest rates, where they turn a profit. And the reason that they want, they get low. Now, I'm not saying, like, okay, people were accusing me of saying, oh, you want everybody just to get a credit card at 3% interest or something. I'm like, well, first of all, why not?
Yeah.
But second of all, like, the point is, that the structure is already there. Like these banks, these member banks, I mean, they're all members of the Federal Reserve. They just get to loan. The Federal Reserve doesn't loan to the public unless you want to just buy U.S. Treasury notes. You just want to buy bonds from the – you can buy those. But you buy them actually from the Treasury. You don't buy them from the Fed. So you can get that. But like the point is
banks get money from the Fed at low interest.
The point is, yes. No, that's the thing. That's what the interest rate is. When Alan Greenspan or when Elena – what? Not Elena Kagan. What's her name? What's that broad, that Jewish broad who was – whatever. The Jew at the top of the Fed.
Which one?
What's her name? The one with the Y. I forget her name. She's the one Yellen. Janet Yellen. When Alan Greenspan and Janet Yellen or Ben Bernanke, all Jews, when they set the interest rate, that's the interest rate that banks borrow from them. And then from there, the interest rates that you get flow downhill. The point is the whole system can easily be nationalized. When the Federal Reserve was created, it was creating a national socialist bank for banks, but not for you. Right?
Right.
So they get national socialism.
Well, that's how America works.
Yes.
America is socialism for the rich and capitalism for everyone else. That's not how it's supposed to be.
I mean, that's an old left-wing talking point, but it's true. So the banks get everything socialized. And like we talked about how the FDIC, sure, it does protect your bank account. So if there's a run, there can't be a bank run anymore because of the FDIC. And the thing is, libertarians would have predicted. Libertarians that don't actually understand, and I was a libertarian for a while, so I get the thinking, but it's wrong. It's just wrong. You got to be able to admit when you're wrong. They would have predicted FDIC would have sunk the banks because they're saying you're protecting the risk has to be there, and the best bank at mitigating the risk is the one that wins. It's like, that's total garbage.
We're almost a century in, and it hasn't.
FDIC has not only not tanked the banks, it made them stronger. And sure, it ensures your deposit as Joe average depositor. Mm-hmm. But the real thing it does is insure the banks. And it makes it easier.
They can stay afloat.
Yes, yeah.
In 2008, afloat. If it wasn't for that relationship, all those banks would have gone under.
Yeah.
Well, especially the investment banks that
And if they so can
essentially,
enjoy
So essentially they have they're basically playing they're playing at the casino with like the unlimited hack.
Right.
Meanwhile,
yeah, it's like if they were playing World of Warcraft and they installed the mod that gives you unlimited gold.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
so if it's so unfeasible, if it's so impossible, why does it work for them?
Well, that's my point. Know? Like, why they get it, but we don't. And that's the system
that is what I always tell people. You know, the real problem in America isn't too much government. The real problem in America is too much finance. The finance capitalists run our government and our economy. Before Alan Greenspan, it was actually the political will of the people was what informed economic policy. That's why we had more tariffs. That's why we had more protectionism. That's why we had more and so on. Now, finance capital is – so think of it this way, right? I mean, I've made this point before, but I'll just reiterate it. Angela Merkel was a pretty popular president, for better or for worse. She was a popular chancellor. Then she opens up the borders and her popularity tanks. Her political career is over. So from a political point of view, her decision made no sense. Who does it make sense for? It makes sense for the finance capitalists in Germany, in America, the Jewish community worldwide. Right. That's who it makes sense for. So put two and two together. That's who's running our countries. You know,
it's another thing is when you know that there's a thing, this is how you've got to look at politics and understand it better. Like, And when you know that there's a thing that's really popular but is never going to get done, like immigration control, right? Like in the U.S., like immigration – and we'll segue after this bit about the banks. We're going to segue into talking about some of this other stuff around this, which you were talking about before. When you know it's really popular but doesn't get done, well, why not? What good is democracy then? What's the point? And I think with the final thing with the banks, my main thing is like, you know, don't let your – and I know there's a lot of people that have some libertarian priors and whatever. And I understand the idea of markets and small businesses and letting people own property, run a business and improve it and make money for their family. And so I understand all that.
Right. I'm but not the little guy that has no access to any of these.
That's the point. So is the little guy is always business. Playing. And even when you look in, and when you look at the little guy, the little small businessman or medium sized businessman who's trying to do everything right, run his business honestly and turn a profit by selling a good product or whatever, he then, if you're white, you're competing against Pajits that are not only dishonest, they get government subsidies. They get minor. Yep. Why does the government give out a minority business loan to foreigners who are not like the reason they theoretically reason is because blacks are incompetent, so you need to give them a leg up. But Pajits aren't incompetent at running a store. They love doing that shit. So why do they get a subsidy to do it against American whites? I mean, it's just absurd.
I think in a more you know, what's more important of all is the impact this has on our media and thus our culture. So as we know, Mike, all media, all anti-white media in particular, is it goes for a loss, like it loses money. Mm-hmm. But why are they staying afloat? Well, it's simple. Venture capitalists. Mm-hmm. So investors that have access to this tap are able to pump money into shit like Vox and Vice and BuzzFeed and things like that. They're able to pump all this money into these guys. And lo and behold, we have this really violent, virulent anti-white media telling you go out and throw milkshakes at political opponents.
Yeah, I mean the New York Times as a company is a billion-dollar company, but they don't make any money from their newspapers. They lose money on it. They make money from their investments, and they have a number of them. And their investments, you know, they might take a liberal line and even sometimes counter signal. They don't do it anymore, actually. They used to do it more than they don't. Now they're just purely pro-capitalist. They've always been, but they sometimes criticize like the excesses of capitalism. And they
What better way to do it than to control the opposition, eh?
Yeah, no, I know. But they are just as ruthless in their investment strategy as anybody. You know, in fact, they've got some of the top Jews in the world. So, you know, it's all bullshit, but who runs the New York Times? Who runs Wall Street? It's the same people. And if you think that those people, if you think it's not literally some of the same people, I mean, like Tucker Carlson said, all these people have Chuck Schumer's cell phone number.
Yeah. You know? Right.
You know, they all go to shul together. They celebrate Seder together.
Dianne Feinstein and Chuck Schumer both represent, I think Dianne Feinstein represents Silicon Valley and Chuck Schumer represents Wall Street. Yeah. So, put two and two together. Why are these the two most powerful voices in the Democratic Party? Is it because, you know, not for nothing, AOC is more popular than Chuck Schumer. Mm-hmm. You know, and she's shitty in her own ways. But, you know, you have other figures in the Democratic Party and the Congress that are far more popular than them. And yet, who gets the veto on everything? Yeah. It's Chuck Schumer and Dianne Feinstein. Why is that? Well, it's because they have Wall Street and Silicon Valley behind them, which in turn also have a direct line to Goldman Sachs, to J.P. Morgan, to all the banks that benefit from the Federal Reserve relationship.
Dianne Feinstein also has a line straight to the military industrial complex. Her husband is a weapons dealer.
Well, there you go. So, like, why? You know, it's no mystery how we got to this point of corruption.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's clear who's doing it, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah. But again, the national bank thing, it's like, yeah, look, when you understand how it works and that the Federal Reserve basically fills the coffers of the banks at low interest rates, they loan it out to you, and any losses that they make, if they make a bad loan and or something like that and they lose that money, well, that balance sheet is just repaired by the Federal Reserve. Now, everyone talks, "Oh, they didn't bail out Lehman Brothers." In my opinion, that was optics. Or it was Lehman Brothers was the first to fall. And then, you know, after that, all the rest of the banks were like, all right, you got to bail all of us out because this is going to happen to all of us one by one because of this housing bubble crap. So now it was like, was it 1.5 trillion or something like that was loaned out? And somebody got mad at me about it and wrote an email saying, don't you know that these funds were paid back? I'm like, right, sure. Maybe they were paid back, but they were paid back from money that was loaned out to the public based on money borrowed from the Fed, reloaned out of interest, and then paid back. But they would have just been under if it hadn't been for the Fed there to bail them out to begin with. So right. If they get this level of security, and I'm sure that the TARP funds were paid back or whatever, like fine, but what was their interest rate? And then on top of that, you know, they were stayed afloat because they were able to have this cushion of support. And then, you know, loan the money out and make profit from people that don't have that cushion of support. So the point is, if the cushion of support works, which it does, why not just make it nationalized for everybody? And then also with a national bank, you can't have stuff like deplatforming and shutting people down, and nobody can bitch. Well, you're letting these evil people use your processor. Well, sorry. It's the fucking U.S. Constitution. What do you want me to do? You know, and so it would just take, but of course, this is not what they want to do. Because it takes away a significant amount of their power. It democratizes the power of banking, and that is terrible. They don't want to do that. And not democratizes it in a way, it just lets people actually, it's not like a gay way of democratizing. It just lets people actually have, you know, control their financial futures, which they don't want anybody to be able to do. They want everybody to be hanging. They want everyone to be managing a load of debt at any one time. And they want to be able to get their debt cheap and sell it expensive. And so that's how it works. And if it works for them, it can work for everybody. That's my only contention. If the risk that the banks face is the risk that the people that they loan money to won't pay it back. And sure, there's a risk there. But the Federal Reserve can absorb that. It's like a huge cushion that these
They also have vulture funds where, for example, if someone buys a house and you know, they can't pay for it and it gets foreclosed, the banks are actually – they take the hit. And they resell the mortgage on the stock market to what they call vulture funds. Some people like Paul Singer specialize in these. Mm-hmm. And they actually sell the cost. Say you have a $250,000 house, you foreclose it, you end up selling it for $50,000. That's what you sell the mortgage for to a bank. So they sell it amongst themselves. They're willing to take the hit. They just don't want little people to benefit from it. You know, that's the thing. But I think we should get to some of these right liberal parties in Europe. We'll talk about that.
But the last thing on the banks is nationalize the banks. Nationalize the banks, give everybody the benefit of the low interest rate and the cushion of the national economy and the ability of the sovereign, which is the government, to create money and to destroy money. The ability of the sovereign to do that will cushion the people the same way it cushions the big financiers and the bankers. And yeah, sure, you'll probably have blacks or something like that that won't pay back their credit card, but who gives a fuck?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, why? That's the thing. It's like people. It's funny because when you have when you think like a libertarian, like people. I was saying this on Twitter, and people were coming at me with some libertarian viewpoints, and they were talking about, "What, you really want to give blacks low interest rate credit?" I'm like, "Fuck yeah, why not? I don't give a fuck. Who cares?"
Well, when you get to that point,
the system can already absorb it.
The problem is that the problem with right wingers is the crabs in a barrel mentality.
Yeah.
So you know, if blacks can't pay back their credit card, who cares?
Who
if
gives
you
a can, fuck?
And you benefit, you and your family benefit from it. Who cares what they do? If the system can absorb it, and you benefit from it,
the system already developed a mechanism to deal with that.
Exactly.
It's just that you don't benefit from that mechanism. So what the fuck do you care? And also, I just don't care. Like, imagine me giving a fuck. That a bank lost money by loaning out to a black. Bankers. I'll just laugh.
That's on them. Yeah, exactly. It's like when I see hipsters getting robbed by blacks. I just laugh.
Yeah, it's like when I saw Arnold getting kicked in the back. Did you see this?
Well, that's not that. I like Arnold to a point, but
here we go. See, I got people were I was laughing at it, and people were coming at me like very pious attitude of what about? And I'm like, if you want to get mad,
do that.
If you want to get mad about black on white violence, how about the Negress that threw an old man off of a bus?
Yeah.
And killed him.
That gets me
mad. That makes me real mad. Arnold goes to South Africa to do some stupid weightlifting thing to signal. He doesn't say a word about the racial violence against whites that's going on in the country. He doesn't say a word about that. So he'll go to South Africa to use it as a prop for to signal his wokeness. Not only that, he was a terrible governor. He was a fucking disciple of Milton Friedman, neoliberal governor.
Oh, yeah.
Hold on, disciple.
You're going to say Arnold Schwarzenegger was a disciple of Milton Friedman? Come on, man. Can you imagine this? Him with his giant steroid muscles and tiny glasses poring over a Milton Friedman book? Because I fucking can't.
Well, dude. No, dude. He did did you not know about the miniseries he did?
They drafted him to run for governor, and they used a celebrity to get into power in California.
Fine.
That's what happened.
Okay, that's fine. Okay, disciple might not be the right word. No, hold on. No, listen. You don't know what you're talking about. Listen, Arnold did a documentary in the 80s. That was it was based on Milton Friedman's book. I forget what it's called. There's a book that Milton Friedman wrote. Now, you can say, again, he was drafted to do this, but he's been a spokesman for this kind of neoliberal libertarianism for a long time. And he did, in the 1980s, he did like a 10-episode documentary teaching the economics of Milton Friedman to the people. I forget what it was called. It was based on the name – Milton Friedman wrote a book. Yeah. No, and that's what I'm saying. He was an ardent neoliberal. I could find it. It's the first episode. It's the thing that they call like eye pencil. Like no one knows how a pencil is made. Only the genius of capitalism can create this or something like that.
God.
That was the first episode, but he did. I think it's called like Free to Choose or something like that. Because Milton Friedman wrote a book, not an economics text, but he wrote one for the masses of propaganda called Free to Choose. And the Free to Choose...
When you got to that last lap in the Phillips curve.
Yeah, Free to Choose was like... Arnold hosted, and he did like several episodes of a documentary. It was on PBS, and then it was on...
Probably reading I mean, he is an actor.
I'm sure... Yes, okay, sure. But also...
Remember, this is during a time when Ronald Reagan was trying to combine the two philosophies of kind of masculinity and conservatism of tradition.
And Arnold was so okay, whatever
global homo economics.
How about
and
disciple?
So
maybe
is it than Arnold?
Disciple may be too strong. Sorry, we're talking over each other. We should stop. Disciple might be too strong of a word, but spokesman. He was an enthusiastic spokesman for neoliberalism, and he always has been. And as a governor, he was a neoliberal. He oversaw, you know, massive non-white immigration to California. He threw away government money on all this green energy bullshit, which was just subsidies to these fake companies that were pretending to make, you know, green energy products. It was just total corporate boondoggles. He's a shitty person. I don't like him. I like his movies because they're funny.
I like his movies,
but he's a shitty person,
like
so I don't care.
Just like Robert De Niro. I love Raging Bull, one of my favorite movies. I mean, fucking Robert De Niro was my hero for a while. And lo and behold, it's just a fucking movie actor. We have to really consider these things. That if you live in America, your heroes are just people playing roles on a screen.
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood, the icon, the avatar of masculinity. Well, you know what? He just plays that shit in a movie. So Hollywood heroes, that's a big problem we have.
Yeah.
You know?
No, but look, I think Arnold movies are hilarious too. But look, the other thing is I've been anti-Arnold for a while, so I knew all this stuff about him. Yeah, I've been onto this guy. Ever since he was governor of California, I've not been able to stand him.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that whole like Free to Choose, that was the name of the documentary in the book. So no, he's not like, and he also was an enthusiastic supporter of Reagan, and he kind of was allowed himself to be an icon that represented like the success like basically the East German, West German thing. Like he was like, like enthusiastically representing, you know, he's Austrian, but he was still enthusiastically representing like West Germany and the whole Cold War thing and saying like, look, the West is free and capitalist and liberty and freedom and everybody back in Germany. He even says like everyone back in Germany is a loser that just wants the state to do everything for them. Meanwhile, look at me.
Yeah.
I came to California and made millions and like, it's like, yeah.
Yeah, with his Jew.
Coming every day.
He had that.
And the funny thing is, though, like Arnold is totally unprincipled because he's been using South Africa as a prop for a while. Because in Bumping Iron, he goes to South Africa in the 1970s under the under the apartheid government, which is actually the National Party. Which was the party that ran South Africa for 40 years during the apartheid regime until it was
A socialist government.
Which a national socialist government. I mean, it actually was. I mean, you know, in the 70s.
We can talk about the history of the National Party. I know the whole thing.
It's a very interesting.
It was started off as a big part of it was a Marxist labor union. And they combined with Boer nationalists to create the National Party, and they took power in a kind of almost anti-imperialist as the British.
No, they did take power in an anti-imperialist
after the Second World War, as British imperialism became weak, they were able to seize power in an election, and the National Party was the one that essentially formulated what is known as apartheid, which is actually a way to protect white workers from being scabbed by blacks that were being imported by the British capitalists, the Jewish and British capitalists.
Yeah, in fact, I would say if people want to look at like some kind of organization model, something like that might be something to look to as something that was a success, particularly in the situation we're in. We're demographically outnumbered. We have to deal with,
whites were only 30 or 40%, if I recall.
Yeah, demographically outnumbered population, a population of people that – now, the one thing that they have that we don't is a very strong sense of ethnic identification.
Yeah.
Which Boers have that – and Boers are also – I mean, there's an element that they're incredibly stubborn people. They're beyond stubborn.
That
served them well when they did the – you know, they created the National Party and they created the Broderbund, which was – you know, means brotherhood in German, because, you know, Boers are a mix of German and Dutch people that settled down there. There's a whole, I know pretty well those histories of Sea of the Africa as well. But yes, they were able to actually defeat the national imperialism.
First thing the National Party did was nationalize all the mines. They nationalized a lot of the big businesses. And the believe it or not, the Communist Party in South Africa was pro-apartheid for a while. It wasn't until the real Jewish infiltration.
Joe Slovo and Jewish.
Yeah, and the National Party was a openly, explicitly anti-capitalist party, explicitly so. And they combined, like we were talking about before, you know, was it – who was that guy? Uncle – God damn. Very famous Boer icon. That was their hero. Uncle something.
Eugene Terreblanche?
No. That guy is something else. That guy's very recent. It was in the 1920s and 30s, the Nazis made a movie about him.
I don't know. I'd have to.
Yeah, but anyway, Uncle something. But anyway, that guy was a big inspiration in the tradition of the Boers in South Africa. It was always very hostile to big business and to banking and to capitalists and everything like that. So,
well, I mean, there's been a – South Africa is a fact. We could do a show on it, so I'm not totally prepped on it right now. But it's a fascinating place. But, yes, I'd say the broader Bund, which then became the National Party, is actually something that we could look to. I just don't – I don't know that whites in America have the ethnic solidarity that they had that helped them form that. But when we're 30% of the population, you know, that might change. That's kind of one of the things I'm thinking about is the – demographic situation. Like, I don't believe that when the demographics tip to 51% non-white, that that's going to be the end of the world. In fact, it might just be the beginning, because
Uncle Kruger, that was his name, Om Kruger. He was the there's actually
guy, or is that someone else? There's a whole weird religion.
Kruger was Paul Kruger was considered.
Oh yeah, he was one of the prime ministers of one of those states. Mm-hmm. Before they were combined into Sea of the Africa, I think it was.
Yeah, it was the Transvaal Republic.
Yeah, so they had like three. There was like three Boer countries, and then what was called the Cape Colony, which was English. And after World War I, that was all consolidated into Sea of the Africa, which was under British rule. And between World War I and 1948. The Boers formed this underground called the Broederbund, and they took over places in the they took over places in the police and the bureaucracy and the army, and then eventually they just took power in 1948. Quite dramatic.
Right. So the Paul Kruger and the National Party both represent a kind of streak of European style nationalism that was very hostile to capitalism and very hostile even to, if you want to call it, Anglo-Saxon influence, but it's really just Jews waving the British flag. Very hostile to that stuff. Very hostile to liberalism. Okay,
and I think it was one of the most anti-liberal parties ever. I mean, they had they had one TV station for the whole country.
Yeah.
Yeah, like they didn't have advertising. Like they would have TV, like in the 1970s in South Africa. They had TVs, but they had like one or two stations all run by the government and no advertising.
Yeah, that's the way you're supposed to do it, Mike.
And they would have like they didn't have any degenerate crap going to their children and stuff. I mean,
no. Even the blacks were better off back then.
Oh, dude, the blacks
by far.
Blacks were definitely better. Are they blacks? Say to this. I mean, if you can catch a black that's not like an ANC shill, that's just like living in one of the desperately poor and violent villages, you know, in the black areas, in some tin corrugated tin hut, they'll say like, yeah, at least under apartheid we had clean water.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Like something that creeped out.
South Africa today looks like directed. It doesn't even look like it has a president. It just has a director. It's George Romero.
South Africa is like an open air MMORPG. I mean, it's like, well, and the other thing is people tell, like, and when I said this about Arnold, like, he's not saying anything about the racial violence directed at whites, which is tacitly endorsed not only by the ANC, but then is enthusiastically endorsed by Julius Malema and his party, which is like sort of a pretend opposition party. That's like the ANC's like, look, at least we're not them. Right. But it's like, in reality, they're, you know, they're all kind of.
I feel zero sympathy for elite whites that love to virtue signal.
Well, hey. You want to know? You go look at those elite whites. Take a second look at those elite whites, and you might find something surprising about them. They might not be entirely white.
Well, no, of course. I'm not talking about just the Jews. I actually, on some level, I'm increasingly more hostile to the Gentile whites that go along with it. Because those people really, I mean, the Jews have skin in the game. They have a long game. They have a plan. What's Arnold Schwarzenegger? Why is he shilling?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's – I mean, I thought that's you meant like in South Africa. Oh, yeah. That's why I said I don't care that a black person
saving their own hide at the expense of their civilization and their people. And that makes me sick. At least the Jews are fighting for their civilization, their race, whatever it may be. You know, I mean, yeah, they're fucking hell-bound demons. But you know what? They're fighting for hell. You know,
that's true.
They're patriotic demons.
What started me down this path was saying, you know, in Pumping Iron, Arnold was happy to use the beautiful South Africa created by the National Party as his backdrop. And now he's happy to go and use South Africa as a backdrop yet again.
And yeah, it makes no difference to him. He doesn't just give a floating fuck. Along. Yeah. He's just floating. So if he gets kicked in the back by some...
I don't give a fuck if some nigger kicks him in the back. I thought it was hilarious. The other funny thing was, you saw the video, right?
Yeah.
Afterwards,
really moved.
Afterwards, the black is yelling, "I need a Lamborghini." Kind of, I mean, in a way, that's kind of, it kind of proves it, like it really is World of Warcraft. He's like, if I kill Arnold, I'll get his loot. And someone's like, Sven was like, he's like, no. He's definitely saying Appletini. Not Lamborghini. I'm like, why not both?
I didn't think of that. Yeah, if you kill Arnold, you get his.
I mean, and I'm sure that. And I at first I thought that was insane. And I was like, wait, no, Arnold probably did roll up in a Lamborghini. In fact, I'd be amazed if he didn't.
Yeah,
he probably rolled up to this event in a Lamborghini.
If you kill him, you get his companions, which are all like crazy bodybuilders. So you get like a security team and everything. Yeah, you know, in retrospect, that black guy might be onto something.
he had the right idea. He's like, look, I'll do a flying kick to this guy's neck. And, you know, if he dies, I get his Lamborghini and his security detail.
Well, blacks generally do think in MMORPG ways. Because, like, they're like, yo, if there's all these white hipsters moving into my neighborhood, I can rob them and I'm rich.
Yeah, so it's like that's just more loot.
That's just more loot.
More loot. It's like, look, I like this new playing field. Yeah.
Like, I saw this thing because, you know, there's a part of Newark, New Jersey. Now, you know Newark pretty well, right?
I mean, yeah.
That's like you stop for gas and people try to sell you crack. Like, that's Newark.
Yeah.
And there's a part of Newark, like there used to be a Portuguese part, but now it's been gentrified. And they showed a picture of a woman going to the liquor store and she got robbed at gunpoint by like five blacks in a car. And that, my friend, that is a raid. That's an IRL raid. In my opinion,
yes, yes.
There you go.
It's like a dungeon raid. Like, yeah, exactly. No, dude. I mean, I remember that Portuguese. Like the one section where white people, when I was a kid, where white people would go because it had a lot of restaurants that people wanted to go to.
Very nice restaurants.
White people love signaling about going to those restaurants. I mean, I would go to them too, but I would only sometimes, not like all the time. Right. And you'd get those. You'd have that Brazilian barbecue where you like. You put the sign up. You're like, please bring more meat, and then you put a green up to say bring it. You put up a yellow ticket to say slow down because we're full, and then you put up a red
one. Brazilian beef is probably the best in the world, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I love going to those Brazilian barbecue restaurants, but then you'd be sitting there, and you have like these old Portuguese ladies or Brazilian ladies come in and sell you. If you're with a girl, they try and sell you like stuffed animals and flowers and stuff to like give it to her.
Yeah,
and.
Yeah. Well, those are gypsies, actually. Those are gypsies.
Oh, yeah. But it's like a regular thing there.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see that kind of stuff anymore.
And arriving to those places is like, it's like playing Fallout New Vegas when you finally get to New Vegas.
Yeah.
It's like the cop, they used to be very well policed, but I think that because, I don't know, there's something going on with they showed a cop on the beat. And it was a fat black woman in a yellow poncho. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm sure she's keeping us all safe here.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing was there was until relatively recently in the U.S. there was some of these parts where you had culture clash of different kinds of people butting right up against each other in urban neighborhoods where different levels of policing and stuff would try and maintain a status quo for one population versus the other, where they'd kind of let the blacks go freestyle on each other, but they'd be like, don't bleed over into the Portuguese area, right?
Right.
Because there's a tax base there. The police department, you know, the police understand, well, look, these people are actually paying taxes.
Yeah.
So we've got to, you know, we'll protect them and we'll keep the white people from the suburbs coming in and this whole little thing. But the problem is when you get like Bugmen, when they become aware of this kind of stuff, they like put it out in the media and start counter-signaling it and developing. So then everything just
they
like,
start
even
creating
that,
cop watch. Yeah, yeah, they do cop watch.
Yeah, exactly. Like even that small amount of order that they managed to preserve out of the chaos just gets thrown down when you get these neoliberal bug people that get in and they start enforcing their shitty middle class morality on everything. Where they you know, and then it's like, all right, so yeah, you get all they're like, we're watching out for police brutality. It's like, all right, well, okay, if you prevent the cops from, you know, beating the crap out of a black guy every once in a while, you know, guess what? This whole business district is now it's now falling apart.
If you're going to take out the level 99 wizards and you're going to start filming them, well, get ready for the orc attack. I mean, that's just going to be how it is, man. That's how Newark is.
Yeah.
That city is a fucking hellhole. I remember
it's a complete shit pile.
Yeah, I remember when they were doing some experiment where Mark Zuckerberg invested like $150 million in Newark schools. Yeah,
he gave $100 million to Newark schools. Basically, he bought a BMW for every fucking school administrator.
Yeah, like at the end of the experiment, it was like the test scores were actually slightly worse.
but you better believe everyone that worked for the school district was driving a fucking new Mercedes or BMW.
Yeah,
or a Cadillac or an Escalade or something.
Right. That's like one of the problems they have because, you know, the black students, they need different types of discipline. I mean, that's I don't like the idea of charter schools, but I understand them and I see why they work better because the charter schools are actually catered towards the black students. You know, so like if the black student like starts getting a little antsy in the class or something, they'll just immediately pull him out. And then bring him back when he's calm and stuff. So like they do stuff like that in those schools. But
dude, they used to do that when I was in school.
Yeah, but it's changed now because
they can't do it anymore. That's what I'm saying. Because you get the bug men in, and they start enforcing, you know, their shitty moral principles and their stupid ideology on this. Like when I was a kid, black kids started to act up. They wouldn't always suspend them. First of all, they would suspend them quite often, but they would take them out of the class until they calmed down, then they could come back in. That was a normal thing the teachers were doing all day when I was a kid. All day when I was a kid, black kids were getting pulled out into the hallway until they could relax.
Well, they're hoping that if they signal loudly enough, Bill Murray will do a special guest bartending in one of those Newark bars. Maybe that's what they're aiming for.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but yeah, it is my whole life. And the thing is then, you know, you do get these – and it's, as you said, you know, these people that aren't getting paid very much that do this because they're believers in it. They're the ones that come in and like, you know, like these busybody middle-class liberal women, they'll come in and they'll see this and they'll be the, you know, ones that don't have kids themselves will be, they're like horrified. Like, oh, what do you mean? Like black kids are getting punishment. And then also, of course, Eric Holder himself had something to do with it where, you know, the Attorney General of the United States is telling schools like, you know, if we see disproportionate discipline rates, like you're going to lose federal funding. And it's like, all
right,
you know, now everything just becomes chaotic.
Is to do two things. It's to stop punishing black students and to start punishing white students more, even for lesser things. So you have a huge dynamic there where like, you know, what does that produce? It produces more black on white violence.
Yeah, and it also produces.
I mean, it's been proven that these experiments don't work and what they've been doing doesn't work. So you can only deduce from what you see there that they are trying to engineer more black on white violence. I mean, that's the only thing you can possibly get from this if you're looking at it objectively.
Yeah, I mean, when you see that it objectively doesn't work and the data are in on it not working, yet they keep doing it, they're either you know, the only thing you conclude is that there's some kind of malicious thing going on because they know, you know, and then when you remove the element of people blinded by ideology, because look, this has been going on for decades.
Yeah.
Decades. And there's no way that you can and this is the thing, the race realist people, and look, I don't blame them for it because on some level when you first become aware of this and you see all the evidence, you want to tell people. So you go out and you do YouTube videos and such, but that's been going on for 10 years now. We now have 10 years of race realist.
We have
YouTube
the facts.
Videos.
What we don't have is the moral supremacy. They are able to keep moral supremacy largely because of hidden factors that we're not addressing. Primarily the Holocaust. Okay. People don't understand how I always get criticized for this as a Wignat because because I always say we have to invest more resources in Holocaust revisionism, because anytime you go there and you say, well, maybe we need to treat the students a little differently and cater to their abilities and so on. What do they bring up? They're like, well, that's what Hitler said in the Holocaust.
Yes. I mean, look, if you see that the opposition to what you're doing, and this is why I don't understand why it's funny, because a lot of these race realist types, they did dabble into that. They eventually made their way into dabbling with that. But then when pushback came after Charlottesville and things like that, they went full kind of, some of them went kind of like full the opposite way into to liberalist kind of stuff, kind of thinking and things like that. It's like, and it's like, all right, you know, I get it. You got pushback and you got kind of scared, but you were onto something when you went from all the race realism stuff and then you started dabbling into the Holocaust revisionism. Because if you see, and they did it kind of naturally because they saw the resistance to what they were saying always came from people that immediately reference the Holocaust.
Exactly.
On top of that, when you remember Godwin's law, which is like the whole thing of every internet argument eventually becomes about Hitler. If that's the case, you know what you're looking at? You are looking at a wide-scale brainwashed population. You are looking at wide-scale brainwashing and social engineering. If every political debate ultimately comes down to the two sides yelling Nazi at each other and comparing themselves to Hitler, comparing each other, the other guy to Hitler, you're just looking at a wide-scale brainwashed population. So we can't do anything until that brainwashing is broken.
The Muslims are actually closer to the truth on how to fight this than we are, because you know they have their own problem, which is Zionism in Israel. And you saw that Al Jazeera video, right? The Al Jazeera video that they caved on, they pulled it back, but they were saying they weren't even saying Holocaust revisionist stuff. They were saying, hey, there's actually other people that suffered in World War II as well. How come they don't have all these special rights and privileges?
Yeah.
And the reality of the matter is, Mike, is that from what the last statistic I saw is that 140,000 Gentile Christians were interned at Auschwitz-Birkenau. Mm-hmm. So why, you don't even need to get into the weeds with this stuff. Like some people see – like some people look at Carlos Montagna, or they'll look at Jürgen Graf, or guys like this, guys that are doing like really specialized stuff on
IHR and stuff
and technical engineering and things like that. Yeah. Like that stuff can be complicated, and I'm not saying everyone has to be totally fluent in that. But you know, there are some basic things you can argue. Like, for example, say, how come there are no non-Jewish Auschwitz survivors that go out and testify?
Right.
Why don't, where are they? Can you name?
Another thing is
You can't, because those people were in those bunks with those Jews in that same camp at that same time period, and none of them saw any gas chambers. So,
and on top of that, there's other things too. Like for example, look at this. Think about this. So when you look at a population of people that gets interned in camps under horrible conditions, and actually there's an intent to kill a lot of them. Well, that actually happened, and it happened to the Germans. It happened to the Germans between 1945 and 1947.
Not Sam Accords. Yes.
Yes. And now the other thing is some of those Germans survived those camps, but because of the trauma that they endured, they all died young. Why do we have all these 100-year-old Jews?
Yep.
If they really endured a bunch of trauma in an internment camp, you know, complications from that last the rest of your life, whether it be stress or trauma or whatever, other kinds of things. A lot of people die young when they undergo that kind of trauma. These people are all lived to 100 years old. Where are they coming from?
Yeah. Yeah. If you were born, I mean, we've all seen that Pauly meme. Hey, Tony, if it's a death camp, why all these women got babies with them?
Yeah.
Yeah. We've all seen that. I mean, if you're a baby born in that environment, you're going to have immune problems, you know, from typhus.
If the environment
like that,
is actually,
life.
You know, what they say it was.
Right. And then there's another one where Pauly. So I get all my Holocaust revisionism from A. Tony memes. Okay.
Yeah. Hey, Tony.
there's another one where Pauly's there. He's like, hey, Tony, why is this guy so fat? And it shows like a fat Jew in the pinstripe pajamas.
Yeah.
Hey, Tony, why is he so fat?
Hey, Tony, if you're going to kill somebody, why do you bother to wash them and shave their head and put them in new clothes before you do it? I don't get it.
Hey, Tony, how come only Jews saw this stuff? Yeah. What is it? They got magic Jew glasses? What is this shit?
Yeah. Yeah, so there's all kinds of arguments, and I agree. Like, we were talking with Dawson yesterday. We were talking about 9/11 and JFK stuff, And yeah. And he was saying, like, look, people that get into the stuff of, like, you can't, you know, aluminum can't go through steel, or temperatures melting at this level and bullets yeah. bouncing around which way and that. It's like, I don't even focus on that. Like, when it comes to JFK, it's like you could go into magic bullet, like, back into the left, bullet yeah. bounces this way. Okay. That doesn't matter. What's up?
JFK conspiracy theories are so dumb that they discredit the other ones.
That's exactly what's going on. And that's, in my opinion, that's possibly at least partly by design. But the other thing is, it's like, look, if you understand the powerful and rich people connected to money and international influence and banking and Zionism and things like that, those people can hire a gunman that will hit, right? That to me is taken as red. They can get an assassin that will hit the mark. So I'm not interested in following the path of the bullet. The issue is who had the money, who had the power, who had the influence, who had the motive. And when we look at that, when it comes to JFK, the case is clear, open and shut, yep. Zionism. And that is actually yep. something that's very little known, because there's so much garbage. It's a little bit clearer with Israel, because with 9/11, because the outcome was so obviously to provoke wars against Israel's enemies. But with JFK, mm-hmm. it's less clear. But all of the other stuff gums up the works. And I think that's by design. Like, as we talked about, a lot of times the media isn't just there to lie to you. It's there to confuse you. You know, it's just impossible for you to think about.
You know, one last thing on the Holocaust. There is one Gentile.
But I wanted to relate that point back to the Holocaust.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Which is that with the Holocaust, if you start going in with people on Prussian blue and the walls couldn't have been this color and this technical stuff, one, people can't get it right away. It doesn't really resonate, and it almost makes you seem like you could be lying to them. Like, they don't, because they've never heard this before, they don't have any way to evaluating it. When you tell people stuff that's hyper technical, they've never heard it before, and they don't have a way of evaluating it, there's no reason why somebody should trust you on the concrete would turn blue and it didn't, or whatever it was, you know. But if you start talking about this other kind of stuff, like, hey, why don't you ever hear from non-Jewish survivors? How is it that every year there's more and more of these survivors? How is it that people that were in death camps are 100 years old now and perfectly good health? You know, how is it that this is a thing that the Jews are using to this day, to extort money from Poland, and now to extort money from 8 different Arab countries, which, by the way, is one of the reasons that Al Jazeera did that video. I don't know if you know about this. They're trying to get the $300 billion out of Poland, a poor country. A rich country, yep. Israel, and a country populated by the wealthiest demographic on earth, is trying mm-hmm. to extort the government of Poland, a poor country, for $300 billion, which, you know, that is making the people of Poland go absolutely apeshit. They're having demonstrations in the streets.
It's more than that. The Polish right of return law, actually, so it's even more sinister. It's not really a right of return law. That's just what I'm calling it. It's a restitution law, but it's like the right of return in the sense that it turns all of Poland into a potential Palestine, because mm-hmm. any Jew or descendant of a Jew that ever claims to have ever lived in Poland during World War II can go to someone's house and say, that's mine now. So it's essentially treating Poland like it's Palestine. And that's a take on the law you can only get in the Polish language. Like, I was only able to get the other side of the story by going on Google Translate and translating from Polish articles to English. You don't get that side of the story in America right now. So, you know, that's pretty preposterous. Because imagine you've owned a house in Poland since 1945, right? After the war, you bought a house. You've had this in your family for 70 something years, and now some random Jew can come to your from New York or San Diego can come to your country, come to your house, and say, that's mine now. You have to give it up. Okay.
And is there any proceeding by which you can defend yourself against this claim? Is there? I mean, there has to be some sort of adjudication. I would imagine it's all rigged.
There's a court, but it's run by this NGO that's partially sponsored by the U.S. government.
Of course.
It's the Committee for Studying Restitutions for the Holocaust.
Reconciliation Commission, something like that.
It's some crap like that. Yeah. And those guys come to your house and they put pressure on all the judges and they pressure your government. And that's why the Polish government is resisting this.
Yes, because there was a demonstration. And the Poles are accurately seeing the hand of the U.S. and Trump even in all of this. And they did a big demonstration.
Oh, no, hold on. Let me clarify something. Mike Pompeo himself is the one that brought this back on the table.
Yes.
Okay. This law was shot down a long time ago, and the reason it's back on the table is 100% due to Mike Pompeo going over there and busting balls.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, this is kind of what you get. And we're going to get back to Trump and Pompeo and what's going on with their hyper-Zionism. I want to get back to that, but I don't want to get
about that Polish law, though. Is one thing it shows about Poland itself is, see, that's what it looks like when politics is still slightly more powerful than finance. Mm-hmm. Poland's financial sector locally is quite dependent on the European Union by proxy and, of course, by ZOG, America, by proxy. But internally, it's still quite weak. It's new, and that's thanks to Soviet insulation from markets. Now, you can call me a communist for saying that, but the fact that the Soviets were able to insulate all of Eastern Europe from markets is why today they're still on the fumes of that system, and the political structure is still more powerful than the economic one. So here you have a situation where you see the transition happening. You see more and more people considering things in places like Romania, things that are politically unpopular but financially popular, like bringing 500,000 or whatever Pakistanis to Romania. That's an idea that got shot down. But who says that 10 years from now, when the financial power in Romania or in Poland gets stronger, these things won't just be slam dunks, even if the people are angry about them, you know? Mm-hmm. The fact that politicians still have to answer to their people in Hungary, Poland, and Romania is why the people most of the time get their way. Once that's gone, once that's devoured, like happened in the United States and Britain and France, once that's over, these ridiculous shakedowns will go along as Mike Pompeo demands.
Well, that's what's amazing is that we're now many years out from the supposed Holocaust, and the Polish government, you know, even after the fall of the Iron Curtain, played along with international Jewry, the government at least, and it didn't really affect the people directly so much. So they were just like, okay, fine. I remember there's a Liam Neeson when he was giving his interview about why he said he wanted to like kill a black guy after his friend was like raped by a black man or something. He said that he was like, we all have to conquer hate. We all have to work together and conquer hate. And he was like, you know, when I went to fill Schindler's List and I was in Poland and I was on my way to Auschwitz and there were people on the side of the road with Nazi swastikas and I couldn't believe it. And I'm like, I can. You know what I mean? I'm like, I can believe it. But the Polish government went along with that for years. And now this is their thanks. This is what you get. This is what you get.
They went along with it partially because of pressure from the Soviets.
Oh, they pressure from, well, I mean, in the brief, I'm saying even after the Iron Curtain fell, though. Like they.
And also another factor at play here is that the Polish have some anti-German sentiments, not all of them unjustified.
Well, that's sort of a funny thing is that you talk to a Poland and they hate Nazis and they hate Jews also.
Yeah,
you talk to a Polish person; they have both sentiments. I've met people like that.
They hate the Nazis. They hate the Jews, and they hate the Soviets.
Yeah.
So like that. So they're willing to go along with anything that will demonize all three of them if they can.
Which is wow. But yeah. But anyway, I don't want to get sidetracked on that. I want to talk more about the reason why revisionism undermines like everything they're trying to do. So you do one. This is one of the ways in which internationally this narrative is used is to shake down these countries. And look, it's unconscionable for the richest group in the world to be shaking down a relatively poor country like Poland, a country that's already in economic problems. It already has a lot of workers abroad in Western Europe. It's got a low birth rate. And sure, yes, the government is going in an anti-liberal direction. It's standing up to the demands for migration, standing up to this and to that. And as you said, that is partly because of the relatively lesser power of the financial sector there, which
markets
is one of the
less developed, yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why you're getting these kind of interventions from the West, and you get people like Pompeo going and lobbying for this and for that. Now, there's also we also were talking about that Al Jazeera video, which said something like the Jews use the Holocaust to their advantage, and part of the reason that Al Jazeera is doing that is because right now they're doing the same thing to the Arab world. So yep. Israel is right now in some international court. They are shaking down 8 Arab countries for a total of $250 billion based on, get this, truly rich. Based on, now these are also poor countries, right? Again, poor countries being shaken down by the richest group of people on earth who also have their fingers in every, you know, international organization, international courts and all that stuff. They're talking about they want restitution for the property of Jews who fled to Israel during the 1948 war. But Jews don't have any obligation of restituting, whatever that word is, giving restitution to Palestinians whose property they blatantly stole, who they, you know, the Nakba, where they killed 10,000 Palestinians and overtook 400 villages. I mean, that was the birth of Israel. It was that day in 1948 when they just blatantly mobilized as a modern state military, and they took over 400 towns. And they killed 10,000 people, and they displaced about 400,000 people. And that was the Nakba. Palestinians called the Nakba. That was the foundation of Israel, where their land was blatantly stolen by force.
When they go to the Israeli border and protest for right of return, they have their deeds from their homes in their hands.
Yeah. And then what happened was in these other Arab countries. Now, the Levant affair is something in which a fake terrorist attack that was going to be blamed on Egyptian radicals was done against U.S. interests in Egypt, I believe. And this was this was uncovered to be a fake thing done by the proto-Mossad at that point, what the organization was called. But it was done by Jewish radicals. And it was done to get the U.S. on their side by blaming Arab terrorists for a terrorist attack carried out by Jews. There was other attacks like this carried out across of North Africa, and part of what the result of this was Jews then were like, oh, the terrorism, we have to flee to Israel. Now, I don't doubt that in the conditions of the Nakba, of the catastrophe, that there were Arabs that went out and wanted to just kill Jews because of what was going on. I don't doubt that at all. But Israel can't exactly complain. When you have literally created a nation out of stealing, blatantly, openly, military force, stealing land and killing people. And then if this happens to Jews in other Arab countries, whether some of it was actually provoked by Jewish terrorism, some of it was probably organic, but I don't really have much sympathy. And at that point, it's like, really, now you're going to go back while you are still blatantly sitting on land that you stole? You're going to sue these countries for basically reappropriating the property of Jews that fled to Israel with no intention of returning? What, now all of a sudden they're going to fuck that? That is so absurd, and it's so maddening, and it's so enraging to Arabs that Al Jazeera, who, now I don't trust them either, all right, just for clarity, like, these people are scumbags. They only release that, why not release that video in every language? Why only release it in Arabic? Because it's there to placate Arabs that are pissed about this stuff, who they then say this, but they're never going to say it in English. In English, what are the videos that Al Jazeera puts out? They put out this AJ Plus crap that's promoting like tranny gay homosexual stuff.
Yeah, that's a hurt us.
And of course, you know, that's done by the government of Qatar. And the government of Qatar is very, you know, now Al Jazeera also put out the lobby. But what happened? They squashed the lobby under U.S. and Zionist pressure, but they got concessions. There's also been, you know, there's also power struggles with them and the Saudis and the other Gulf Emirates and everything. And there's all kinds of, I don't know all of it. Like, you can, and the Kushners are involved somehow. I don't know how all of it works. It's very complicated. But the point is, there's power struggles among those people. And these are some, it's not Al Jazeera is like such a, is such a principled organization. They're not. Okay. No. But that's why they don't put this out. They don't just put the truth out.
When you see them going for attacking the Holocaust, though, that means that they're using their atom bomb. They're using their nuke. That's the nuke the Arab world uses against the Zionists, because they know that's the myth. That's the nuclei of neoliberalism. That's what informs or rather grants the moral justification for every immoral policy Jews put into practice in many contexts, because it's not just used to steal lands from Palestinians. It's also used to steal lands from whites.
Lands from Polish people. It's used to justify anti-white policies in the U.S. and Western Europe.
Yeah. So remember before I mistakenly said that there were no Gentile witnesses to the Holocaust. There were. It's a man called Paul Rassinier, Rassinier. And this man was a communist. He was in the 1940s, he was arrested by the Gestapo for hiding Jews. So
he's a French, just so everyone gets it, he was a French leftist and a member of the much vaunted French Resistance. Although French Resistance, a lot of that is exaggerated, but it's romanticized and exaggerated by the Jewish media. But to the extent it existed, this guy was in it. You never hear about this guy.
No. So Paul Rassinier was he was taken to Buchenwald, and he was brutally tortured by the SS. He actually, unlike these Jews that live into their hundreds, this man died in his 60s due to injuries to his kidneys that he endured while being beaten by the Gestapo for his resistance activities. So anyway, this guy went in by the 1960s. There was that's when the Holocaust myth started to kick up, right? That's when they started to give traction to it. And it was really the first person to write the first chapter of the myth was a Jew named Raoul Hilberg. It's a very famous book. It's called The Destruction of the European Jews. This is basically what put Holocaustianity on the map. Mm-hmm. So Paul Rassinier read this book and said, hey, this doesn't really add up to the things I saw in these camps. Mm-hmm. So he wrote a book in 1964. He wrote a very authoritative book. It was like a parody of it. It was called The Drama of the European Jews. And in it, he says, this is a quote from it, says, With regard to the gas chambers, the almost endless procession of false witnesses and falsified documents to which I have invited the reader's attention during this long study proves, nonetheless, only one thing. Never at any moment did the responsible authorities of the Third Reich intend to order, or in fact order, the extermination of the Jews in this or any manner. Did such exterminations take place without orders? This question has haunted me for 15 years. So he said very clearly that there is no evidence that the Nazis had any program to exterminate the Jews. He wrote another book, actually. It was called The Real Eichmann Trial.
Yes.
Again,
the Incorrigible Victors. I'm looking at his list of works right now. He also wrote a book in 1950 called The Lie of Ulysses, A Glance at the Literature of Concentration Camp Inmates. So it's funny how there's like, oh, these people that were all in death camps. There's like an entire genre of literature developed in these death camps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And here you have a communist who is persecuted by the Nazis for hiding and helping Jews.
Oh boy, here we go. Another book, 1955, Parliament in the Hands of the Banks. Oh my God.
So this guy is not a Nazi.
No, in fact, no, far from it.
There's no evidence he was an anti-Semite. He was anti-Jewish.
He tried to protect Jews, I believe, right?
His life was cut short due to his activities protecting Jews. And this is the thanks
he gets.
They shit on his grave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what this is what it is. I wonder if you can get a copy of this book, if you could get a copy of it in French, much less in English.
You know why?
I'm sure it'd be very difficult to get an English translation of this book. No, probably almost impossible.
Let me give you a little bit of historical background. So Rassinier's data, he uncovered a lot of wartime, for example, the famous almanac that shows the Jewish population increased during the war afterwards. That was discovered by Rassinier. Mm-hmm. This was actually kept hidden for a while until Harry Elmer Barnes, who was a well-known historian. He wrote some authoritative books on the First World War and many well-respected books for the Second World War. He discovered Rassinier's revisionist books, and he started to publish them in English. And that's where you get the Barnes Review. That's still they publish, I believe, still. They have a lot of Holocaust revisionist books. But, of course, the big dagger to the heart of the Zionist dragon was Arthur Butz, Professor Arthur Butz, who collected a lot of Rassinier's research and put it into a book called The Hoax of the 20th Century, where he says in a quote, "I will offer here no definite estimate of Jewish losses. However, I have no reason to quarrel with Rassinier's estimate," which Rassinier said about 987,000 to 1.5 million Jews may have died during these concentration camps, and it was largely from diseases. He said Rassinier also said that no gassing took place. There's no policy of extermination. This was purely circumstantial deaths, like many millions of others in Europe at the time. Many people starved to death. Many people died of disease. This is not unusual. So this grain of truth that there were some Jews that died in these camps due to disease and famine was taken and it was sprouted into this gigantic hoax that is used it now. Because remember, Mike, the lesson from the Holocaust isn't that war is bad or violence is wrong. It's that war is good and violence is great. And yes. Any amount of violence you can do to someone who would do such a thing is totally justified. Yep. The Geneva Convention doesn't matter. You can burn them alive in Dresden. The basic human decency doesn't matter. You can kill 3 million German civilians by ethnically cleansing them from Eastern Europe. No. That's the lesson from the Holocaust.
Yeah. And that's where you get the lesson is we can't.
We see today.
I mean, today, even the language around World War II in figures like Neville Chamberlain and Quisling is, these are appeasers. You can never do diplomacy. The wages of diplomacy with Nazis are all these deaths. So you have to hit first and hit hard and not give them a chance to argue, not give them a chance to, et cetera. That is, and it's a moral lesson. And so people, this is why you get, I mean, ultimately, this is why you get these incited liberal bugmen going out and throwing milkshakes. I mean,
exactly. Ultimately,
this is the final, this is finally all comes first, full circle. This bugman
comes back to the Holocaust.
This bugman on some level believes he's preventing another Holocaust.
You know, Neville Chamberlain told Joe Kennedy in private. This is
this is another reason that the Jews hated John F. Kennedy. But yeah.
Yeah. Joe Kennedy, though. This was a.
Yeah. No, I know. I'm saying like because of Joe Kennedy's politics, they never liked. Anyway, good.
So Joe Kennedy was told by Neville Chamberlain that the Jews started World War II, that he didn't want the war. No one many people in the Anglo-British establishment didn't want it, but there was a corrupt element in it. There's a corrupt element represented by figures like Churchill that worked with American Jewry. He said that, American Jewry, to essentially engineer this war into something it was never meant to be. It was meant to be a small war that would be, the war would happen, a dummy war, a phony war would happen while they came to the negotiation table with Hitler. That was the actual original idea, according to Chamberlain. And then these other figures came. They overthrew them, and they started this barbaric loss of life where 50 million people died. Mm-hmm. And for what?
Yeah.
You know, this is the main lesson of the Second World
War. And none of those other people – that's another thing you can bring up, a basic point that you can bring up when you talk about this with people. It's like, again, getting into the specific autistic details is a little weird right up front, and that's part of what – Some people's resistance to it. One, the resistance to it is natural when you've been brainwashed and programmed your whole life. I don't hold anyone responsible necessarily for resisting it. I understand if you've been brainwashed, you've been brainwashed. But it also comes if people are starting to go right into sort of technical details. I think it's more convincing when you look at why don't we have a memorial for other people? There's millions of other people not in the category of Jew that died and died horrible deaths. We don't have memorials for the victims of Dresden.
Yeah,
and then the only time
or Paul Rester,
and we don't hear anything about him. And the only time you get a category that is allowed to be talked about as someone else has suffered in the Holocaust, it's homosexuals, right? Remember, they started to introduce, but only tentatively. They're like, oh, yeah, also homosexuals. And you'll see Jews doing this now because they're hot on the gay rights thing. Like, okay, you can also talk about how they were persecuted. Were put in camps, etc. And so it's like they're still you. It's like. Because homosexual is the agenda, they're tapping into the old programming and they're bringing it forward. It's like, oh, Hitler also tortured and killed homosexuals. They were also gassed.
Well, let's just do a quick rundown here on the USC Shoah Foundation. They're kind of like an archive of Holocaust testimony. Here are the numbers. Let me just pull up the numbers here. So there's Jewish survivors, 51,000. 435. Rescuer and aid provider testimony, 1,160. Liberator, those are the soldiers, 429. Sinti and Roma survivors, 406. Political prisoners, 268. Miscellaneous, 174. Jehovah's Witnesses, 84. War crimes trial participants, 62. Non-Jewish forced labor, 14. So, we had, according to the official figures, maybe 140,000 Gentile forced laborers at Auschwitz, and yet only 14 testimonies are taken. And of these testimonies, from what I'm gathering here, none of them really talk about gas chambers.
They probably just talk about how the guards were mean to them or something like that.
Well, some of the testimonies in general, so there's 50,000 Jewish testimonies. And a lot of them, if you actually look into them, contradict each other.
Of course.
They're kind of shady on the details. So essentially, not a lot of Gentiles witness these miraculous Holocausts.
Also funny, the liberator, meaning troops that supposedly went in and liberated these camps, 429, how many, you know, and we also find out that some of that stuff ends up being false later on. Like, there have been guys that have been caught lying about it because, you know, they wanted to grab that glory or that money or whatever.
Yep.
And, you know, and how many of those are Soviet versus American, you know?
Yeah,
that's liberated, supposed liberators on both sides. So funny. That's the only context in which you talk about Soviet army moving in and you become liberated, right? Right? Like, oh boy, thank God the Red Army is here. Now we're liberated.
Yeah, that was like the Robin Williams movie when they see the Red Army popping.
Yeah,
I think that was the one. But the point here is that most of these testimonies do not talk about gas chambers. It's largely a uniquely Jewish experience. So what exactly was the policy then? So the Nazis were going to gas the Jews, but not the Romas? Or did they gas the Romas and the Jews? Did they kill the non-Jewish Gentile laborers? Mm-hmm. Or did they – I mean, it's very confusing. They don't go into details. I mean, just ethnic Poles alone in Auschwitz were 140,000 ethnic Poles.
It's also funny. Now Douglas Reed – in Controversy of Zion. Now, Douglas Reed, some of his earlier stuff in the book is a little bit esoteric and weird religious stuff. But as you get into it, it gets more and more – because he was a journalist, right? He worked for the – I believe it was like the London Evening News or something like that, like a paper. And he was one of their more respected journalists. He wrote a book, very internationally acclaimed, called Insanity Fair, which is about – because he was anti-Nazi too. He was basically Anglo-Saxon liberal. Against the Nazi regime, but he also was documenting what he was in Berlin when the Reichstag fire happened. And so he was against Hitler. He didn't like the Nazis, but he also saw from the beginning that Jews were lying from the very beginning, that they were the only, they're lying that they're the only people that are suffering. They're the only people the Nazis are rounding up. He's like, they're lying about that. He's like, they're picking up everybody that's a political dissident. And then it was like, but then later on he got more and more into this. And in his book, and the great thing about him is that he was a newspaper reporter. So he's picking up on like little hard details from the time that have now been lost in grand historical narrative. So that's why his work is valuable. He's a little bit weird when it gets to the esoterics, but that you don't have to pay any attention to that. You can take from books.
It's like E. Michael Jones. E. Michael Jones has a chapter in his book where God comes down and blows up the Temple of Jerusalem.
Yeah, that's Douglas Reed. Douglas Reed isn't that. He's not that out there. Okay. But again, I find that stuff interesting, but it's like, you don't need to deal with that. You can go to the middle of the book and look at his World War I and World War II stuff. Yeah. And it's fascinating because it's very detailed, very in depth. So he says this, the leading American reference book, The World Almanac, in 1947 gave the 1939 Jewish world population as 15,688,000. In later editions up to 1952, it increased this pre-war estimate without any explanation by a million to 16,643,000, gave the 1950 population as 11,940,000, which, if subtracted from the first figure, gives a reduction of nearly 4 million. However, if based on this estimate, on another estimate, namely that 1950, the Jewish population of the USSR was 2 million. That left unanswered Mr. Lefwich's question, that's something from earlier in the chapter, in respect to Commissar Mikhoels, who was the Jewish commissar for the Soviet Union, who said that in 1943 the Jewish population of the USSR was 5 million. In England, Whitaker's Almanac of similar eminence struggled with the same problem in its 1949 and 1950 issues, gave the 1939 estimated Jewish world population as 16,838,000.
Wow.
Out of 1949 as 11,385,200, a reduction of 5.5 million. However, the figures given for the Jewish population in separate countries when added up up to 13 million, not 11 million.
Yep.
Incidentally, Whitaker's in 1950 gave the Jewish population of the USSR as 5.3 million against the World Almanac's figure for the same year of 2 million. So basically all these figures, and he's talking about how these almanacs, like contrived that they put it to justify the Holocaust in 1950. They put like, here is the 39 versus the 1949 population, right? And he's saying they had various reductions by 4 million, 5 million. But if you have that, so you have two editions of an almanac that say we have the same reduction of the population by about 4 to 5 million. But one of them says there's 2 million Jews in the USSR, and the other one says there's 5.3 million Jews in the USSR. So how can those numbers possibly square? And then he's also saying that another one of them, when you take their total Jewish number, it's lower by 2 million than their number of all Jews added up in different countries. So it's not even internally consistent. And then he says, finally, the New York Times, which may be described as the world-leading Jewish newspaper, in 1948 published what it claimed to be an authoritative statistical article computing the Jewish population of the world, 3 years after the war's end, between 15.7 million and 18.6 million. So then that just blows all of those almanac figures out of the water. So his point is that these numbers are deliberately obfuscated. Like, nobody really knows how many of these people there were. And he also says that, like, a lot of these censuses were, like, they were taken later on. I mean, there's a whole in-depth chapter on it. I don't want to go into all of it, but that's kind of the artistic stuff.
Yeah, and there's more contemporary stuff that really questions, because one of the big gotchas they have is they have the Yad Vashem in Israel has a list of the millions of Jews that died. But Carlo Montagna, who's this probably the number one revisionist scholar alive right now, he actually looked at the Yad Vashem list and compared it to the German archives, and he said there's no actual list of Jews that died in these camps. The only list the SS had were Jews that died in ghettos and Jews that were shot through SS courts for crimes. So in other words, the Yad Vashem list of names is a total fucking fraud. It's bullshit. That's why I think there was recently some Israeli that went to Hungary. There's a documentary about this. I don't know what it's called or where it is. But anyway, there's a documentary where he went back to Hungary, to where his parents came from, where they allegedly his family allegedly died in the Holocaust. And he actually found his own name as one of the deceased in the Book of Dead Jews. So –
I didn't.
So in other words,
you get these stories. Like, they released a story recently. I saw some stupid Twitter video. Like, this 102-year-old Jew, is like, it's like for 70 years he thought his family were dead, but they weren't. And then they, like, reunite them, and they're all crying and stuff. And I'm like, 70 years? It's like, this guy. It's like, how did that even happen? You know, I didn't really look into it deeply enough to know, because I just don't care. I mean, the whole thing could have been a setup, you know, for the cameras. But it's also just right. Like, I mean, it's funny when you see stories like that to troll them. You'd be like, oh, wow, isn't it great? Less people died in this thing than we thought. That's amazing. Now, you'll get, like, blocked immediately when you say that kind of stuff. But that just shows you, like, how fragile it is. And look,
it's not a troll. I mean, if you're Jewish, if you're a young
wouldn't
Jew,
you think
you
heard would be
that
great?
Someone tried to exterminate your people, and then someone says, wait a second, no, they didn't. Wouldn't you be relieved by that? Like,
I mean, it depends if you're gaining power from that narrative.
Right.
Though, that's the thing.
Only if fear of genocide alone was a problem, you would be relieved by that.
Yes.
But if you have an ulterior motive, then that makes you upset. Just like the facts, you know, just like the Jesse Smollett case, right?
Yeah.
Like, people, there's more people upset that Jesse Smollett wasn't a victim of a hate crime than there were people relieved by it.
Yep. Because, I mean, they were wanting that
gay
crime
black Jew,
to justify.
Wouldn't you be relieved by that? Yes.
They wanted that crime to be true to justify a political outlook and a political program that they want to embark on, and that gave them ammo, and the fact that it was fake set them back. I mean, fake hate
and
crimes.
Do you see the relationship? Because who were the people that were trumpeting the Jesse Smollett thing? Who were the people? It's the same people that promote the Holocaust. So do you see their relationship with the facts, their relationship with the truth? It's quite, let's just say, liberal of a relationship.
And their relationship to narratives that that promote like a evil victimizer versus poor victim narrative, and, you know, what they do with that. You know, like it's not just, I mean, they lie, sure, but they're also lying in a particular way that promotes this idea of the victimized peoples are powerful now because, and of course, we also see how the structure of the U.S. government, I mean, all this anti-white stuff comes in as a result, not just of Holocaust narratives, but then building on the Holocaust, the civil rights movement, where blacks were then, you know, now they've somewhat abandoned this. We talked about this with Ahab a couple of weeks ago, how they've somewhat abandoned the blacks, but they did use them at one point, and they got, you know, once they get affirmative action in, which is meant to squeeze white people out of institutions, you know, blacks aren't as useful to them anymore, but the blacks were very useful to them in getting that kind of stuff in getting ways in which they can squeeze competent whites out of institutional power, using things like affirmative action. And now that that's been accomplished, blacks can just languish in their ghettos and use drugs and whatever. They don't care as much anymore. Now they're still used in some ways, but this is the point. And so we just have to, if you're willing to call bullshit on Jussie Smollett, you should be willing to call bullshit or at least examine other narratives that unfairly slander your race on behalf of giving a whole other race of people power. You should be willing to, and you can't just say, I don't care about it, because the problem with the I don't care about it, which is on some level a first step towards being kind of woke on this issue. The problem with that is, one, you know, it's like Sargon recently said, I'm sorry, Jews, but I don't care about the Holocaust. Gotten a lot of crap for it. Although, funny enough, he got in more trouble for the rape thing than he did. There was like one day of hysterical coverage about him saying that about the Holocaust, but they're not hammering that home. What they're hammering home is the rape tweets.
Well, that's like very similar to what they do to Tucker Carlson. Like, Tucker Carlson makes a mild criticism of immigrants as being prone to littering, and it turns into this whole big thing. But we know that's not what it is. It was that just a few days before he was attacking the Israeli wall.
Yeah.
That's hypocritical. He's going out there straight up saying, why is it that the people that support the wall in Israel are vociferously against it in America, including on moral grounds? And so while the fig leaf is always some stupid faux pas, it's always some small taboo like Sargon's rape thing. That's just the fig leaf. It's because they don't want the other thing to be the problem, the real problem, because they don't want a debate to get started.
Yeah, they don't. I mean, even Sargon sort of saying,
I'm looking through some sleuths, including Carlo Montagna, that actually look through the central database of Shoah victims on the Yad Vashem site. One of them that they uncovered was a fake name, Edith Frola. And they usually – what it is they have a profile. You can go on their webpage and search these people. They usually have a profile of them where they talk about their last name, their title, their gender, their age, when they died and so on, when they were born, where they were born. And one of them is someone called Edith Frola. And the picture that they use is Magda Goebbels. So
on some of this stuff, like – not to counter-signal it, because it's all true, and even I was doing a little bit of the autistic, like, number crunching and stuff like that, and that's fine once you get into it, but I think when you're talking about it with people, I think an effective line of attack, I mean, you can get into that stuff, and that stuff does get, once you've gotten past the power of the Holocaust over your mind, you can go and look into the stuff and you can learn more about it. But when you're talking to people that haven't gotten into it yet, I think it's easier to get them to turn their minds against it by saying things like,
I have to push back a little bit. I agree when you're talking to people. But I think the few people that are doing the hard
work. Oh, no, they absolutely should be doing it. I'm not counting.
The conservative is a problem because he believes empirical facts are everything, and they're not. The leftist is a problem because the leftist believes slogans are everything. And if you have slogans and you're just pushy enough that you can get anything you want. Both are wrong in many ways. You need both, a little bit of both. And one thing, I made this appeal on the People Square last week. I want more young guys with engineering minds, guys with mathematical minds, to actually get into this stuff, get into Holocaust revisionism, because the people that are doing it right now are really old. Okay, Carlo Montagna is fucking old. This other guy, I'm not sure, is Farrison still alive? Robert Farrison? If he is, he's probably in his 80s. David Irving is old, and he's kind of like browbeat. He doesn't want to do this stuff anymore. So we need young blood into this. Unfortunately, I saw the committee for open debate on the Holocaust. Every person that was promoting it in the video had gray hair. Mm-hmm. So we need young blood in this movement, in this intellectual movement, to fight the Zog. This is where they are weak. And if we're able to fully disprove this, just like exposing the Gulf of Tonkin incident totally discredited the Vietnam War to a large degree, or was one of the stepping stones to fully discrediting it. This would fully discredit neoliberalism as we know it, which is why they put all these crazy, crazy guardrails around it. Mm-hmm. You know, so this is more important. We have so many resources poured into IQ stuff and haplogroups, and there's SPIRGs that map out all the haplogroups and all that. The thing is, like, there's universities doing that already. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're using your free time for that, there's no reason for that. They're doing it for you. What you need is something that has no institutional support and never will, which is Holocaust revisionism. This is more important than anything. How is it that there's so many people out there wasting their time talking about the moon landing and stupid shit like that, but no one is really getting into this? Mm-hmm. This is our magic bullet, friend.
You're definitely right. And the fact that, like, as I said, when you know that the country and the society, really, not just the US but Western Europe, is totally affected by this because of things like Godwin's law and other like narratives, the fact that you can't, like you said, you can't even advocate for treating blacks differently in the public schools based on aptitude because of Nazi stuff immediately comes up. So this narrative has to be attacked. And Sargon saying, like, I don't care about it. Well, I disagree with that sentiment, because it's certainly – it's like one of those things, like, you might not care about it, but it cares about you. You know, even that was something that they don't want out there because, again, they don't want Sargon to have a platform to say that. Because that will
that's the real problem.
That emboldens more and more people, which is why all the pearl clutching over the rape tweet. Now, I said to Sargon, my message to Sargon, I hope he listens. I mean, there is a possibility of him seeing what we say. You know, I put it out there on Twitter and people were trying to get his attention with it. I put it out there on YouTube. It's like, Sargon, every time they attack you for your rape tweet, attack them for Rotherham. Attack them for their silence on Rotherham. You know, if you want to just saying, like, fuck you, I got a right to talk about rape tweets. That's not really going to motivate anybody. But if you say, oh, yeah, you care about rape so much, where were you on Rotherham? That's going to really hit them right in the...
The BBC actually made a pretty good documentary on Rotherham, too. So it's not like it's treated as a conspiracy theory. The establishment has fessed up to it to some degree.
Well, they couldn't hide it, so they had to kind of own it and bring it under their own rubric.
You know what, though? As shitty as the BBC is... That actually is a check in the column of being for state media, because because of the fact that so many people knew about it, the BBC, and because, you know, people were cut, because there's a license fee that goes to the BBC. So every British person that participates in this has to pay for the BBC. So by having this public stake, as shitty as the BBC is, by having this public stake, people feel like, hey, why aren't you giving this side of the story? And they were forced by the public to cover the Rotherham case. Okay? So meanwhile, in America, you can't force the New York Times to cover anything. You can't really protest outside the Washington Post, say, hey, why aren't you covering this story? Why are you covering this up? Why are you doing this? You can't do that with private media because it's private property.
Well, they also just don't give a shit. Like, they just don't care. Like, they just
they don't care. It's that these are platforms for private capitalists, private Jewish interests, private investors. So you can't tell them what to do. But in the case of the BBC, I mean, that's what this guy, Varangian Guard, he's a Russian. He lives in Russia. And he was telling me about state-owned media in Russia. And he said, you know, state-owned media is ridiculous in the sense that you'll get things like, you know, oh, Vladimir Putin hits a hole-in-one again.
Yeah, that's absurd.
Vladimir Putin wrestles an alligator.
Did you see the one where Vladimir Putin discovered like two ancient Greek vases while like snorkeling in the Aegean?
Right, but what he was telling me though, what he was telling me is that, you know, that stuff is stupid and ridiculous, and people just laugh at it in Russia. Yeah. But you know, it's very easy to see through that. But at the same time, because the media is state owned, there's a pressure on the state-owned media to represent a whole myriad of political opinions. So he says you'll oftentimes get like an open fascist or a national socialist on Russian TV talking about racial stuff. And then at the same time, you'll get an open communist debating him. Like, this is stuff that is only allowed on YouTube and is increasingly restricted nowadays that you get on state-owned media in Russia, you know? So you get access to different ideas in Russia. Meanwhile, in America, we don't. Our media doesn't the political agenda the media promotes in America is entirely the agenda of the money power, which is what? 1%, Oh, well, 2%, you know?
Yeah.
That's the agenda that they push. It's totally alienated and alien from the interests of the average American. So that's why no one watches TV or reads newspapers anymore. In a sense, that's bad because it makes people less political. In a sense, that's good for the finance capitals because they want us to be less political.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but that's you know, the depoliticization of Americans is I think changing. People are getting politicized. It's like, and it's starting with, you know, it seemingly, it's, you know, when you look at how seemingly much of the population is politicized, it's to be in this sort of like liberal, anti-Trump, anti-fascist direction. But that's not, that's just because that's the voices that are amplified by the media itself when they pretend right. like they're listening to the people. They're really just like, that's kind of an engineered politicization, but you know, people are getting increasingly political and that is ultimately, they are nervous about this, which is why on one hand, you know, they're trying to amp up these people that are easily manipulated by neoliberalism, like the kid that threw the milkshake, and they're trying to censor in every other aspect all
Sargon's been hit with milkshakes about 3 or 4 times
it keeps happening to him, and
campaign.
You know, the funny thing is that we know that Sargon doesn't actually promote racial stuff at all. Like, he's not lying when he says it. They don't know that because they only listen to the liberal corporate media, so they have no idea. These are anti
Farage.
What's that?
Farage doesn't support racialism.
Yeah, I mean, Farage.
We could end the show with that, talking about AFD Farage.
Yeah, let's move on to that. I would say Farage. I mean, I would say any of these populist politician. Now Sargon, the problem with Sargon is he's not even a populist. That's why he's failing, because he's still doing the liberalist thing, which is like trying to squeeze, you know, juice that doesn't exist out of a classical liberal orange. It's not working for him, and you know, so people just see him as a dick that wants to treat.
He's milking a very skinny cow.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not really working out for him, and you know, that's why you will get someone like Farage who will put out a pot. I mean, Farage is a neoliberal. I mean, UKIP was a neoliberal party when it started.
It always was.
Yeah. And now it's, you know, he's trying, and that's, he's not even part of it anymore. But of course, now it is because they've got Sargon. So it's still, you know, but anyway.
Sargon actually represents, this is why people were saying, oh, wow, UKIP is going to put Sargon in the driver's seat. Like, why? Well, Sargon actually is ideologically what UKIP was all along.
Yes.
He's a very good representative of what UKIP is.
Yeah.
Like, he's like the perfect representative. He's actually a little edgier because he has like contact with youth culture. But what UKIP has always promoted has been what Sargon promotes, which is privatization, classical liberalism, you know, kind of eternal skepticism towards government and things like that, you know, hostility towards labor, like workers. So like, that's UKIP. You can't expect right liberal populists to do anything about immigration, because it's like we were talking about last week. We were talking about Vox, remember, in Spain? So Vox does what UKIP does. They do what AFD does, which is they try and combine a kind of Christian morality with market liberalism, right?
Right.
And a dose of Zionism. So this was something that was first championed by Ronald Reagan.
And they'll even go after Muslim immigration, but only on the grounds of only on liberal grounds.
Their main gripe with Muslim immigration isn't that it's, you know, brown bodies in a white Europe. Yeah. Their main gripe is that they're not assimilating fast enough.
Exactly. It's always a critique from a liberal perspective.
Yeah. Their solution. I actually almost prefer the social democrats and say, no, let the Muslims have their parallel society, because at least the whites and Arabs aren't mixing. The UKIP and AFD and Vox solution is to get these Africans and Arabs and race mix with them. So is that really what people want?
I mean, that's what Nicolas Sarkozy said. Remember that?
Yeah. Again, he was the conservative.
And he was the liberal, like the neo, like, yeah, he was the neoconservative, really. But I mean, he was Jewish, and he's Jewish and a neoconservative.
Well, one thing that it reminds me of is America in the 1980s. So Europe's demographic winter right now is remarkably similar to America's in the 1980s. I mean, European countries are demographically about 80% white, say Britain, Germany. Mm-hmm. And that's what America was in 1985, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing kind of – they're using an old playbook, which is influenced by American Jewry.
Yeah.
It's again, you combine kind of Christian moral ethics. Like some of these parties, like AFD, is actually relatively hostile to gay marriage. They're actually changing that now.
Yeah.
Because they're doing the clever rebel media Breitbart thing of including fags now. But they're pretty hostile towards transgenderism. They're hostile towards gay marriage. They say a lot of good things about the traditional family, mom and dad and child. The problem is though is that they combine kind of a philo-Semitism or philo-Americanism with this capitalist economics support for Israel. So basically, you can't be pro-immigration. I mean, you can't be anti-immigration, the effect, and then be an eager bootlicker for the cause. And that's what I mean by this. Like some people would say, like, what do I care about economics? What do I care about what policy they have towards Israel? As long as they do something about immigration, I don't care. Well, the problem is that they're not going to do anything about immigration. That's what Donald Trump has showed us. Donald Trump, we're all guilty here. We're all guilty. We overlooked Donald Trump did not hide his.
We were willing to overlook the Zionism if we thought we were going to get something on immigration.
Yes.
And the problem is now they, in my opinion, they played that card. And sure, I fell for it.
We all
and but they're not gonna fool me twice. You can't get fooled again.
Exactly.
And these parties are trying to fool you again. And so if you see a party, the upshot here is you see a party is promoting neoliberalism and Zionism, but is also claiming that they're gonna do something on immigration. You know, you could play Machiavelli and be like, well, you know, I'm gonna let that slide. Every party has to pay, because in the U.S. particularly, you'd say every party has to pay lip service to Zionism. But I want that wall and I want that immigration reform.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they're paying lip service to you and not to the Zionists.
Maybe they're paying lip service to you to get elected so they can impose these other unpopular policies. I mean, that's what we've gotten with Trump.
That's literally what we got with Trump. We didn't get immigration, and we got hyper Zionism.
I remember I brought it up again. I supported Trump in 2016. I'm not going to lie about that or hide that. I supported him into 2017. I started getting a little iffy after Charlottesville a few months after. But regardless.
I got real iffy on Trump in 2018. And then he actually – I'm not going to lie. He sucked me back in towards the midterm elections. And then after that, I was like, all right, fuck this.
Well, you can attest to me. I didn't get sucked back in.
No, Stryker did not get sucked in. I kind of halfway dipped my foot back in the waters. I like tested them, and I seem tepid.
You kicked Donald out the house. You told he was sleeping on your couch, and then you finally said, you know what, Donald, you got to go. You got to get out of here.
Yeah.
And then Donald came back with a guitar outside your bedroom, and he serenaded you.
Yeah, he played In Your Eyes with a boombox over his head outside my window.
As a med, what I did, I took his clothes and I burned them on the sidewalk. And I'm like, Donald, you're not coming back in here. You let him come back, Mike. You let him come back in the house.
Briefly. All right? Just briefly.
No, but what happened with Trump, I remember I was talking to David Duke about this in 2016 when Trump was getting elected. And I said to Duke, I'm like, you know what, Duke? I love Trump. He really is – he's standing up for us. He's standing up for white working people. But here's the thing. I'm really getting suspicious about the hostility towards Iran. Like, who's that for? I said that when he was running, because he was not hiding it. He was not hiding it, people.
No, he did. He went
after saying he's going to pull out of the nuclear deal. He was saying Iran has to be stopped. He was very hostile towards Iran. And I thought the same thing. A lot of people think about AFD. They think, oh, he has to say that. I thought the same thing. Didn't you, Mike?
Well, I mean, I was willing to go with the narrative of everybody in the U.S. has to pay lip service to Zionism. They have to pay on some – you can't oppose – now – no one's going to go openly against the Jews, but you can't oppose every Jewish agenda. You got to give them something.
Right.
You know, and what he was giving them was this Iran stuff. And he went to some astroturfed protest of anti-Iran deal people with like the guy
from, I remember that.
The guy from Duck Dynasty or whatever the fuck. Like, you know what I mean? You remember that guy? Yeah. Like, That guy who plays a redneck on TV but isn't really one. He pretends like he hunts in the woods and like he wears an American flag bandana and crap, and he's out there like, oh yeah, I gotta get the Iranians, and you know, there's totally AstroTurf protests that nobody gave a shit. So he did. I was like, look, he's gotta give him something. And this is what he's giving.
We were pretending not to see it.
Yeah.
And we also didn't want to get crazy in the sense of being, you know, maximalist. Because there's some people out there that are maximalists, and what I mean by that is they want all or nothing. They don't see how you can work towards things, towards increments.
Right.
But in this case, the maximalists are actually the Zionists, because they've gotten everything and more from Trump on that front. So yeah. We got all the bad stuff Trump promised, none of the good stuff.
Yeah.
And even when Trump kind of suggests some of the good stuff, like pulling out of Syria, he gets smacked down and overruled.
Yep.
So the point I'm making here is that
AFD, this emergency, just so everyone gets it, this emergency wall declaration, that was also theater. Where's not a single – nothing's been built. Not doing anything.
It's like I was saying the other day, like, hey, what do you think of the Donald Trump social media stories where you can send him your social media star?
Well, that was the thing. It's like – that was –
why doesn't he have an email chain or a program where you can send him your invade Iran stories about how much you want to invade Iran? Oh, right, because that's a serious policy he's actually going to put through.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't say, give us – that's really, yeah, here's our invade Iran policy. We want to hear from you. No, I mean, look, everybody mocked that right away, which was the correct response, which was like, oh, okay, I get it. So one, he's doing the bit where he's pandering to you. He's making you think he gives a fuck, and he's letting you feel like you're – now, we all didn't fall for it, but there's a lot of, you know, boomers and less intelligent, you know, more conservative type people and things like that. They fell right for it. They started
Facebook jail.
I saw, like, Trump tweets this out, and I saw someone on Twitter, some random conservative account, like, tweets at him, like, my account was removed from this, and I was just like, oh my God. I was just like, guy, this is, but no, like, come on now, like,
yeah. Nobody. So the AFD. So in America, for example, you have this crop of shills, and maybe you can do the Chomsky stretch, the Mr. Fantastic Chomsky stretch of saying, well, you know, the evangelical Christians, they want to hear about this. Fine, you can make that argument. But what demographic in Germany gives a fuck about Germany's Israel policy? Name me one. Who the fuck asked AFD what their opinion on boycott, divestment, sanctions was? Who? Yeah. No one.
And on top of that, Germany has a lot to lose from a disruption of Middle East oil. Like, if you see a party in Germany signaling, and this is part of the reason why it's so unpopular, is not just because they oppose U.S. wars on principle grounds, because they suffer. They directly suffer when the U.S. fucks around and Israel fucks around the Middle East, because they're more dependent on Arab oil than we are.
Oh, how about the refugees they get?
And then the refugees. And if they don't see the connection, but I mean, I think a lot of them do, but there's some that might not. Their parties certainly are never going to talk about it. You're never going to have a now, will an AFD politician stand up and say, we oppose U.S. Zionist war in the Middle East? One, because it hurts us. It hurts our interest in importing oil from the region, and it hurts us demographically, because these wars inevitably lead to refugee flows. If somebody would stand up and say that, I'd be like, there's a principled politician, but no one's doing it.
Well, that position is illegal. Like I said this on Twitter. That's a funny thing.
They practically make the actually – in Europe, they almost make the actually good positions illegal. I mean, that's crazy.
I said some controversial things on Twitter that some people were angry about, but I believe them to be true. Like, the first thing is that the only way a political party or structure can defeat the immigration problem in Europe, the only possible way where they can institutionally do it is in by having two platforms. One, anti-capitalism. It needs to be a party that opposes finance capitalism and capitalism in general, global capitalism, all of it. Two, it needs to be an anti-American party, because German Jewry itself is actually not that powerful. They're powerful compared to Germans, but that's only because they're propped up by American Jewry. So if a party doesn't want to go after Jews specifically, they can just declare themselves against American interference and influence in their internal affairs. Because that's really the problem. Because if you try to do something like the Polish are doing, where they're saying, no, we're not going to pass this Holocaust immigration law, and they don't have a financial finance sleeper cell in your country to tap, then what they'll do is they'll send Mike Pompeo out to threaten you.
Yeah.
So you need to have a very stern policy. Germany can do it, where they say, we're not going to let America influence our internal affairs anymore. And then, only then, can you possibly do something about the immigration problem. Because immigration in Europe is caused by big business interests and Jewish interests, particularly from America, that are influencing their domestic policy. It's not all this shit about, oh, women, they want to bring blacks and Arabs into their country because they hate white men. Or that's all stupid fucking surface level stuff that you're seeing. The real deep problem, the roots, is you have to uproot American Zionist influence from Germany, from France, from Europe, from our motherland, from our fatherlands in the old world. You have to uproot it. In a sense, that puts a lot of pressure on us, Mike. I mean, I'm talking about you, me, all of us here in America, because we have probably the most important job in modern history, which is that we have to defeat the Jewish power structure terrorizing and murdering our race out here in Washington.
That's my thing. Is like we have to undermine its power from here at home. And like if they, you know, if we're ever even talking about going into level of like military conflict with Europe, you know. But
the point I'm making though is that this is our burden. We have, so anyone out there, if you guys are jerking off, playing around, trolling, you're infighting, DNC, getting into personal squabbles, I hope you all know that we have the most important job in the world. We have the power to save the world here in America by stopping the Jews out here in Washington. Because once we do that, everything falls back into place. These politics they have in Europe, there is no historic precedent for Germany having a market, free market, libertarian, Christian, moralistic, and Zionist political party. And that's the one leading the populace.
Yeah,
that doesn't exist in Germany. It doesn't exist.
That's quite crazy. And of course, you know, you could get sidetracked by the fact that the liberal media in Germany, or the leftist media, is like vehemently against these people. And that's part of the whole show that's put on, right? And yeah, they're doing the bit. Think about it. Like, they triggered the libs. Sure. If you get one of these faux populist, really kind of Reaganite, really Reaganite is the best word for this, mixture of Christian, phony Christian moralism with neoliberalism and anti-communism and stuff. I mean, it's funny because that didn't take root in Europe, but now that we actually see Europe's demographics mirroring what the U.S.'s were in the 1980s, we're seeing this type of party come. I mean, that's a fascinating. I didn't notice that before.
Today,
I didn't notice that until you pointed it out. It's really true. That type of party is now coming in vogue, but we in the U.S. have seen this trick. Yep. And some of us even fell for it again with Donald Trump. Donald Trump, they kind of ramped it up because, you know, they wanted to
Donald go Trump
with
literally ran on Ronald Reagan's slogan, make America great again.
Yeah. But he was saying things that Reagan wasn't saying. He was talking about, you know, real immigration. And Reagan wasn't even addressing immigration. He's talking about real immigration control. He's talking about nationalist policies to revitalize the manufacturing sector, revitalize. Mm-hmm. He was talking a good game. And
what stage of capitalism is this?
In the end,
maybe when Germany gets to 55 or 60%,
they're going to get the same. They'll get a Trump.
Man, holy crap! Did we just uncover a massive multi-layered conspiracy over here?
I don't know if it's a conspiracy so much. It's a conspiracy in that it's the elites developing to react to the reality that they've created for people.
Exactly.
And so when America is at a point where racial pressure is high, I mean, don't believe that it's not. Like, you see, I mean, and whites are not just getting woken up by the anti-whiteness on Twitter. That's a symptom of the whole problem. Whites are getting woken up by going into a school and being like, holy crap, this place is a fucking zoo.
Going to the Mall of America and getting thrown off.
Or going to college and going through this mandatory diversity training and going into a college classroom and having the teacher literally inciting the non-whites against you on racial grounds. And then when you say, but hey, what the hell? I like being white. There's nothing wrong with it. And then someone comes like, no. We're not doing identity politics. We're doing classical liberalism, individualism, right? Morgoth had a video. I love Morgoth.
I love Morgoth.
Everyone's
got
to look at his stuff. He had a video out yesterday where it showed a white teenager getting mobbed by like five brown teenagers in UK. And he's like, the worst disservice you could do this guy, this white kid, is tell him, be an individual. Don't be a member of a team. As he's getting mobbed by members of a team. That's what you get when you're the lone white guy. Here's five brown people having, you know, beating the crap out of you in an alley. That's right. What you get.
And it's too perfect to be a coincidence. I mean, the fact that, you know, someone was telling me, I mean, I know a lot of guys that listen to this even are fans of AFD or they're in the AFD. And I totally see your point. I see the situation you guys are. You guys, you're desperate for something to happen. The problem is, you know, it's kind of a paradox. So what you need to do is illegal politically. I'm not even talking about violence or anything like that. I'm saying the very political platform you need to fight the actual demographic problems in Germany is illegal. The NPD is the only group, the only party in Germany that has the right idea. And they are infiltrated up the ass. They're constantly being surveilled. They have they're constantly fighting the courts. Their members go to prison and so on, right? Udo Voigt is actually in the European Parliament. He talks about this all the time. But the thing is, like, you know, you just have to figure out a way to push through it. Because the AFD, you know, just so you know, even if the AFD is legit, like the leaders aren't cynics and they're not in on it, even if they aren't, they're making some massive tactical errors. Because everyone I know every German I know in the AFD has told me that, like, you know, if they find out that you're sharing edgy memes on Facebook or that you're doing something like that, they will rat you out themselves.
Well, that's like all conservatives. And you know why that is? I mean, that is the pattern of conservatives everywhere, is we're willing to go this far. And even those that even some of them might even at some point have a good intention, like, we're willing to go this far, but no further, because when you're on the right or nominally on the right and you're constantly guarding your right flank more than your left, when you're this is a pattern that's repeated over and over again. The only thing we can think is that these people are aware of who it is that's behind their back watching all the time. And the people that are behind your back watching do not care about political violence. They do not care about someone being a radical, someone being off the reservation with crazy political ideas. They care about somebody being only that way in a particular way, because they don't care about wild, crazy communists whose policies have no hope of being implemented.
The AFD does talk a lot about Antifa. Like, one of their members almost got killed by an Antifa. So, like, they care about that, but they also treat that as equal to their own team, and that's not how it's supposed to be. So what I'm saying here is that when you have, say, let's say you're a genuine conservative, like, I think Sargon is largely a genuine conservative. Mm-hmm. He's genuinely a liberal. So when you have a situation like that, you know, and Sargon isn't even doing this at this point. This is more so AFD, Vox, Sweden Democrats. So you have a situation where you announce that you have zero tolerance for racism and fascism and Nazism. Fine. You want to make that a strategic thing? That's fine. The problem is you have an entire media apparatus that will do opposition research into all of your parliament members, all of your candidates, all of your members, and they'll find something they wrote on Live Journal when they were 15 years old where they said something about Jews. Mm-hmm. And then you're under pressure to purge them. This could be the most energetic and effective activists, and those are the ones that are going to attract the most attention from the media. And they're going to really, really track, like they did to Sargon. They listened to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of Sargon, and they found something. And now UKIP is under pressure to purge him. They haven't so far, but, you know, when you set the precedent, they're just going to keep doing it. Like, this is what a friend of mine said. He said, you know, in the Catholic Church, all sins are forgiven in the Catholic Church. In politics, no sin is ever forgiven. So if you're going to play that game of the game of contrition with them, you're just going to spend all your time apologizing and purging your own.
Right. They box you in that way. So when you go out with the attitude of, like, because they think that it's, and the thing is, you get these conservatives, and I don't know if they're shills or if they're genuinely dumb. They think they're, like, outsmarting the left by doing this.
Right.
Or they think that they're, like, dealing with the problem of leftists that are constantly trying to expose all of them as Nazis by doing this, by saying, we have no tolerance for this. We have none of these people. And it's like, well, in fact, you do have those people. Like, you can't be a right-wing party without having Nazis. I'm sorry. It's just even how it is. No, even the no, Republican
even
Party.
If you, like, no, hold on. Even if you don't have those people, you'll have someone that's adjacent to them.
That's what I
mean. That may have at some point used language that they use.
Right. And like we saw, like Turning Point USA recently, a video came out of two top Turning Point organizers who were saying like nigger or something like that. They were in a hotel room having a party and they were like, they probably were genuinely just joking around or flaunting flaunting the taboo of saying nigger or whatever. And this comes out and I guarantee you those two aren't working for TPUSA anymore. I guarantee you they've been fired. And what does that do? That just means that you practically have to take all your people's phones away if you're TPUSA. Because anything that they say, there's a whole group, well, as you said, the whole, as soon as you send a signal, we're willing to purge based on trivial violations of liberal social media code. Basically, you've given the liberals all power over your party. Your party roster is basically up for a vote by the opposition parties.
So I'll tell you what the clever conservative thinks here. This is their strategy. Their strategy is, well, if I do this, then I won't have as many problems with the law. I won't have, you know, I won't be set up like the Ram guys. I won't be sued by Roberta Kaplan. Like, that's their mindset. I'll also get money from big donors. Like, for example, if Mercer wants to give me $10 million, he won't be pressured by his board of directors to quit his finance firm. You know, that's what they think, and it's true. But the reason you're left alone in that sense is because they can control you through another means. Mm-hmm. So if they can control your discourse, if they can control who you have in your party, and if they can control who you can and cannot criticize, then ultimately they've neutralized you. They don't need to go to the courts or the police or the lawsuits. So that's why you're not being clever. You're actually being outsmarted. They're able to control you while expending very few resources and, most importantly, while protecting the credibility of liberalism. So you are, in a sense, protecting their credibility because, you know, if – say tomorrow AFD refuses to apologize, refuses to purge people, refuses to do what they say. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. You have a party with 20% of the electorate in their pocket, roughly so. The German government starts to aggressively infiltrate it with police. They start to put their MPs in jail. They start to put their activists and sue them. That will discredit liberalism. That is actually a form of accelerationism. And in the eyes in Germany today, in the eyes of the German people, if that were to happen, that could have some very nasty ramifications. And the government of Germany doing this would have to make quite a few trade-offs and really be careful on how they do this. So it's actually better to push them. That's what the Golden Dawn did. You know, the Greek government forever has been discredited. Thanks to the Golden Dawn being very, very persistent and very principled. So, for example, I'm not saying that you have to be super extreme. You do have to make some concessions if you're going to be a populist movement. But you don't have to make concessions to the enemy. Right. You have to make concessions to the people.
Yeah.
So, like, if the people have some kind of, you know, let's say the Greek people themselves are not out and out national socialists, right? Because most of them aren't. Then you may have to make some concessions on your symbols, on some of the books you sell or whatever. But you don't have to make any concessions to the media or the government.
Right.
That's not your target demographic. That's not who you need to impress. Right, right. You need to impress your people.
Yeah.
And conservatives that instead go and they do this thing where they signal that they want to ban BDS, they're not doing that for the people. They're doing that for the elites.
Yeah,
so if AFD isn't bought off, they know who's in charge and they're signaling submission to them. That's what this is about.
Yeah. And that's the perfect example, because I just know more about American politics than European, is that, like, you know, you have outlets like the Daily Caller where, you know, some members of their staff are outed as having had dealings with Richard Spencer and the alt-right, or having written opinion pieces previously that, you know, that didn't go along with basically that were white nationalists, right? They had white nationalists on their staff. They all get fired. But who does that – do you think people reading the Daily Caller give a fuck? No. They do not care. Even if they're not white nationalists themselves, they don't care. They don't care that Scott Greer – was an editor at the Daily Caller. There's not a single Trump fan, Daily Caller reader that gave a shit that that right. guy was editing the Daily Caller. So why did he get fired? He got fired as a concession to the left.
He got fired as a concession to the Jews.
Yeah, well, that's He got fired as a concession to the Jews.
You know,
Jews. Yeah.
Facebook is really transcending left and right in its own way.
Yeah.
You know, the Daily Caller is able to sit on the Facebook news. Like, they have a seat at the Facebook news thing. Like, they have this thing where fighting against fake news, and the Daily Caller is actually sitting on it. But the implicit agreement is that
they don't get labeled fake news because they fire people like Scott Greer.
Well, they still get labeled fake news by certain elements of the left. It's the people, the adults in the room that you don't like, for example, people in The Guardian and Gawker and Huffington Post, people that don't matter will label you fake news anyway. What gives that weight is if the adults in the room take that seriously and apply it in their business practices, in who they deal with and so on. So if you're going to be the Daily Caller and you go out there and you say, we're not apologizing or firing Scott Greer, suddenly you have an advertiser boycott. Suddenly you're targeted by sleeping giants. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you have Facebook saying, nah, you're not allowed on our board of real news curation anymore. Suddenly you're out of money and suddenly you're out of business. And that's why they do that. And so they think they're clever. It's like, well, you know, it's better to do something than nothing. Well, you know what? At the end of the day, looking at a retrospect in the demographic and racial emergency, I don't agree anymore. I don't necessarily agree anymore. Because the Daily Caller has become ultimately useless for the most part. You know, there used to be a point where they would publish things that mattered.
Yeah.
Like, you know, why haven't they published that chart of all the journalists that work with Antifa? It's only about a dozen leftist journalists that hate the Daily Caller and would like to see it disappear. Why isn't the Daily Caller giving this man a platform? If the shoe was on the other foot, the Huffington Post would be giving him a platform.
If some independent researcher went out and found, like, oh, look, here's 10 journalists who are secretly alt-right, working with the alt-right, planting stories, pushing their agenda.
Yep.
You better believe that would be national news. Every paper
doxing
would cover
people.
It.
Oh, so here are some alt-right people that send people's doxes to the Daily Caller and get them published to ruin their lives. Do you think the Huffington Post would stay away from that?
Do you think the New York Times would stay away from it?
CNN, would they stay away from
that? No, every outlet would cover it. Every outlet would cover it.
Meanwhile, we can't even get a fucking glorified blog like the Daily Caller. That's what it is. It's a glorified
blog. It really is, yeah.
We can't get them to cover it.
No, it's because of the added. It's because of the people that are running it, and now we have. We started to talk earlier about Human Events, which is again, Human Events is going to fail. I was making fun of it the other day. Human Events is going to fail because it's the same. It's just another outfit that's doing the same thing. It's run by Will Chamberlain, who's Jewish, and Raheem Kassam, who's from Breitbart London, so he's willing to be kind of this edgy. Ironically, edgy Muslim face on neoliberalism, and then they also hired Ian Miles Chung.
I'm surprised by that because Ian Miles Chung on a live stream told me that he agrees with National Socialism.
Well, I mean, so, Ian Miles Chung has.
I don't
pretty,
know what happened.
Well, what happened is that the guy, like, look, I don't know much about the guy, but. I have heard from other people. I don't want to spread rumors. It seems like he is willing to write for the high. I mean, apparently he is. He's willing to write for people to give him money, and he's willing to write what they want him to write. That's what it seems like.
There's a lot of mystery behind Human Events because I've looked into who the fuck is funding this, and there's a lot of shadows and a lot of mystery, a lot of dark money that's being invested. It's a lot of money, by the way. It's millions of dollars are being invested into Human Events to have it take off.
And they're claiming that they're not.
Who's providing it?
They're claiming that they're not doing that. But it's not going to work. I actually looked at website ranking, and TRS is twice as popular as Human Events. Now that's already based on the flawed Alexa ranking, which is already not picking up like 70% of our users because of ad blockers and lack of Google Analytics and everything.
We're not on Google. Yeah.
Yeah. We're not on Google. We're not searchable on Google.
Some of you're not on.
Actually, Google Analytics was working after we were kicked off Google Search, but I don't use Google Analytics because it tracks our users, so I removed it from the site many, many months ago. So we don't have any of that shit. The only stats I have are the direct server logs themselves for traffic, and believe me, we're doing well. But But yeah, like, so, you know, they're not going to, it's not going to work. Like, what do you need human events for? What are they going to do that's different than what Breitbart does? Nothing.
I was talking to
they're gonna,
someone.
Well, you know what they're going to do? They're going to talk. Their angle is because the first editorial by Ian Miles Chung was about PewDiePie. So they're going to try and they're literally trying to bring in that kind of internet video game culture stuff and mix it with classical liberalism and conservatism. And it's not going to fucking work. It's not only is not going to work, it's going to be fucking cringe.
Not only is it not going to work, these guys 2 years from now are going to end up just like Gavin McInnes. I mean,
Will Chamberlain is Jewish, so it probably won't happen to him.
But. Maybe not him, but definitely Chug and definitely the Muslim guy. Because I was talking, not for nothing, but Laura Loomer is Jewish and they fucking ruined her.
Will Chamberlain's Will Chamberlain's a team player with the, but he's not, he's literally counter signals people for being too extremist. So he's on their team.
Full disclosure here. I was talking to someone in the know who knows a lot about Gavin McInnes and knows a lot about his time at CRTV. And basically what they're telling me is that do you know what CRTV is?
Yeah.
It has that same guy from the Duck Dynasty, the guy that did anti-Iran march. Like I'm sure a bunch of fucking hunters, a bunch of rural
they really care a lot.
They're really passionate about the Iran deal. But so that guy's on it. Michelle Malkin, which by the way, I say this all the time because a lot of people haven't noticed, but Ann Coulter was switched out for Michelle Malkin and no one even noticed. Mm-hmm. Did you notice that? Michelle Malkin has replaced Ann Coulter as the voice of anti-immigration. Which is a total con, by the way. So Michelle Malkin's on it, and what's that bitch? The bitch with the titties, fucking Stucky.
Beth Cup?
No, not that one. That's the one with the legs.
Yeah, but she's still never Trump. I don't know.
No, not that one. No, Stucky, Allison Stucky.
I don't know who that is.
So. She's on CRTV. Was of course Levin, he's the owner. And of course Glenn Beck,
yes,
a guy who's totally discredited, no one respects him, no one ever respects him, and yet he was brought in on this deal. How curious. He was brought in where they merged the Blaze with CRTV, where it's now called Blaze TV. But anyway, someone I have in the know was telling me that CRTV is losing, or Blaze TV, whatever it is, it's losing money like crazy. Like there's no audience for it. The one flagship they had, the one guy that really brought in some subscribers was Gavin McInnes, and they fired him.
Yeah.
And I heard some stuff. So basically what happened is that a bunch of Jews got together at a table and they looked at some of these George Soros style studies where they showed that Gavin McInnes was actually a gateway to the alt-right. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Very impersonally, with no regrets. So Gavin McInnes was always a lifetime Jew bootlicker, right? He's always been sucking Levin's ass and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Long story short, the SPLC starts to really crack down on Gavin after basically the elders of Zion came to an agreement on him. And they left him out of the house, man. They really threw him out. They really threw him out into the rain.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was something I was saying. Like, the thing is, it's like with Gavin, the problem wasn't that he wasn't kissing their ass, because he was. The problem was that he was talking about things in such a way to attract a certain type of personality that didn't stay satisfied with Gavin.
Right.
Because of the way his personality was, he was attracting. And the same thing, frankly, happened to the Proud Boys. Is that, you know, he took in guys that were interested in that kind of a group to be in. And when you get those type of guys, they're not going to stay on the neoliberal plantation.
No, because the ideology goes against the Proud Boys are a kind of civic fascist organization. They can deny it. They can sue the SPLC over it. And I encourage them to. Mm. But the energy they bring is a fascist energy. It's not the energy of a Proud Boy is very different from the energy Sargon gives off.
Yes.
Sargon is a true believing classical liberal. The average Proud Boy, you know, knuckle dragging Proud Boy thug isn't.
No.
If you're a knuckle dragging Proud Boy from Long Island and you're like, bro, and you wear a backwards baseball cap, like that is a kind of implicit American fascism. The only reason they're not racist is because they want to reserve the right to fuck Asian girls and stuff. Like that's
Yeah, and they've got Latinos and Polynesians and stuff in the mix and whatever.
You know,
it's fine.
Those guys are fine. Those guys are cool. I like Tiny. I like those guys.
Well, I mean, I remember –
you know what's funny? Not for nothing. I'd actually – in the case of that guy, I would actually like – I like civic fascist Polynesians more than I like classical liberals that could be 100% Bavarian phenotype. Because the Polynesian civic fascist is going to get me closer to where I want to go than the classical liberal. So,
well, I mean,
more power to them.
Yeah. No, and I don't mind it. You know, it is what it is, and it's the fact that, I mean, look, what you should look at instead of like, now this might cause controversy if anyone listens this far in the program, that when you look at the Proud Boys. You could nitpick through that what they say they're about. Oh, we're a men's organization. We're anti-racist, anti-fat. I mean, Gavin was saying all this really cucky shit, and that was theoretically the platform of the Proud Boys or whatever, right? But no one really believed that. And you know, why did they go after them? Why did they go after them? You know, and they went after them for a different reason. I mean, nobody believed them.
Why did they go after
them
and not TPUSA?
Yeah, no, I mean, TPUSA is objectively whiter than Proud Boys. Right?
Probably.
No, it is. I mean, before TPUSA started doing direct outreach to blacks and Hispanics, and not just by direct outreach, I mean money.
Right.
You know, like giving money to like Candace Owens types, who's now left that. I mean, look, whatever. We could belabor the point. The point is that like, they went after Proud Boys for a reason, because it was the wrong energy. Gavin, because of that energy that he was creating, despite all of his pro-Zionist, pro-Israel, you know, hate fascists and Nazis crap on Twitter. Like, remember when he was still on Twitter before he got banned? He had that as like his – he thought that was like his defense shield. And we kept saying, Gavin, it's not going to work. We knew it wasn't going to work. And on some level, he probably knew it, but it was like his last desperate – attempt to stay afloat, stay out there online in the public eye. And it failed because Gavin organized what they saw as a fascist gang. And his politics attracted people who would be 6 months later alt-rightists.
Right. And the Proud Boys have also been very effective in neutering the street communists. I mean, they are an effective. They are like the Fry Corps.
Well, they've been. They were for a while. Effective. They've been neutralized with arrests and
quieter, but not quite entirely quiet. You still see them coming out against the communists and against the anarchists, and that's the real problem the system has with them.
Yeah,
because the system's agreement is to use the communists and the anarchists as a kind of indirect force to do the dirty work that bureaucrats and liberals don't want to do. You know, that's the whole thing about punching Richard Spencer, throwing milkshakes at people. Like, go throw a milkshake at a Proud Boy. Go throw with – they don't do that to Proud Boys.
No, they're not
going to
do that.
Like, the thing I'm saying here is that in the case of Gavin, according to people in the know, I'm not 100% sure of this, but, you know, this is what I've heard. Gavin was fired without any explanation, without any real – like reasoning, like he's actually kind of dumbfounded by it. He's been a loyal soldier for Zog, or rather the right wing Zionists for forever, you know, for a decade now. A loyal soldier, bringing in subscribers, bringing in new fans and everything. And they, and when push came to shove, Levin sided with the Jews at the SPLC against him.
And it seems
that
like it doesn't
show
make
you. If you think you're clever, no Jew has any loyalty to any non-Jew.
Yeah.
Just keep that in mind.
Yeah. And it seems like, again, this is the final point, it seems like it doesn't make any sense at first. Until you look at the fact that there was a study done that was like, oh, and it is true. Like, they were right. Gavin was, I mean, I can't tell you how many TRS fans tell me, oh, I was a Gavin fan. You know, people come in from different areas, but that's one area where a lot of people came in. And they were like, I used to hate you guys because you would always troll Gavin. And they're like, but then I realized that you were right. And,
but you know, furthermore, Gavin was very powerful, kind of like Anthony Cumia. He's very good at reaching white working men.
Yeah, he has something.
The Proud Boys are a working – you know, the reason the Proud Boys are probably more – somewhat more racially diverse than TPUSA or the DSA.
Because they're based in New York.
The reason – no, not just that. It's also because the ones on the West Coast, Oregon and Washington are pretty diverse. The reason that they have more non-whites in there is because it's a working class movement. And if you're a working class person, you're going to have more non-whites in your life. And many non-whites that are working class, and when I say working class, I mean guys that actually work in construction and stuff like that, like black guys or Mexican guys or Asian guys that work in construction. They're around white working men all the time. And that has an impact on them to some level, you know? So those guys are kind of in that culture too. Nothing against them at all. More power to them. You know, those guys are patriots. Fuck it. And what I'll say ultimately, though, is that Gavin was able to mobilize that working class energy into a political vehicle, which what happens when working men, the guys that drink at the union bar making racist jokes, what happens when they get political, right? Those guys are not supposed to get political, because when they do get political, you get fascism. Yeah. And that's something the left learned in the 1920s. They had this whole working class labor movement run by the communists. They were sending them. They almost overthrew the German government. One day, someone says, wait, we agree with all the economic stuff. We will give you the same things, but we can also love our country and our race. And the working men all defected en masse to the Nazis and the Mussolini people, the fascists, you know, the Italian fascist party. So lo and behold, the left has abandoned the working class because we are fascists. That's why. The way we look at the world is a fascist way of looking at things.
Yeah. So, and they, yeah, I mean.
So that's Gavin's sin. Gavin's sin is uniting white working men.
Yeah. And that's why it doesn't matter that he mouthed all of this Zionist crap, because, you know, having had some insight into Proud Boys, having briefly been in some of their groups before I was purged, before people were told not to talk to me, etc., I would see what was going on in their Facebook groups or their Slack groups and things like that. I'd see the kinds of stuff they would talk about. You know, I would, whenever I'd meet someone that was in the Proud Boys, they either didn't know who I was, or if they did, they liked me. You know what I mean? It was like, it was never, it was, you know, and to the extent there was anybody that was against TRS, I mean, for a while, being a fan of TRS would get you kicked out, but only because there were people that they were putting treacherous people in charge. I mean, look, we could go into this whole history.
They have minders. Like, you know, the average black boy loves guys like us. It's the minders. I mean, even the non-white ones think we're cool.
Yeah. There's a whole history there, which I don't want to necessarily go into, because, you know, some of it's personal and doesn't need to, you know, not everyone needs to hear about it. But the issue is that,
it's the minders, usually Jewish or usually handpicked.
Or there's another characteristic they would have, which would be gay. But that's other thing.
That's new. I think the Proud Boys at this point, because of the dynamics going on, they're kind of weak right now. But I hope they're able to reorganize into a harder shell, into a better, more ideologically coherent group, something, an ideology that actually reflects how they are. You know, classical liberalism, private property, the entrepreneur, those are the rallying calls of the Proud Boys. But is that really something you're willing to give?
Were they really motivated by that? I mean, I don't know.
Not for nothing, Mike. Some of those Proud Boys, they go out into the street and they're not afraid to die. They're not afraid to die. They're not afraid to give their life. And it makes me think, are you really doing it because you're an entrepreneur and you love low taxes?
No.
Or is it because you're proud of the shirt? That's their yellow and black shirt. You're proud of your crew. And on top of that, you love your country and implicitly love your race. You know, was it that? I think so. And you know, that kind of brotherhood is quite beautiful. That's why I refuse to counter signal the Proud Boys anymore, because they've created a brotherhood that has actually stood through some tests, and it deserves admiration. Now, part of the reason it stood through some tests is that they were in that gray area where they were signaling for Zog, but then not being so. Now that's starting to run out. Now they're really going to get tested, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I haven't heard much about them in the last few months, but I think the point stands either way. But that's all the time that we got today, so we'll have to pick it back up on all this next week. So thanks, Stryker.
Thank you.
We will see everybody next week.
Bye. See you.